sponsored by Hooters Air. Visit Hooters.com or see stores for details.
Must be 21 or older to win. Hooters Air flights are public charters operated by Pace Airlines.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a new career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-903-1919 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-903-1919. That's 1-800-903-1919.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Pleasure to be with you on this Sunday night, as we are throughout the years. And hello to everyone in our immediate WRIF listening area. That covers quite a ways. A big signal here from 101.1 FM. But also to all of you listening on the internet all across the country, all across the world. Again, always kind of thrilled to get this international email. I guess maybe you should get over it by now. But I feel good that a lot of you, some of you ex-Detroiters listening in other states, some of you just happened along, found the station on the internet, searched. I forgot what people have looked up. And then all of a sudden, there's my show. Suddenly, people in Latin America, Asia, someplace, are listening to the show. So welcome to all of you. It's a pleasure to be international. Here's the old ZZ Top song, I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide. Well, I guess it doesn't work out. Hey, I'm bad, I'm international. That's bragging anyway, so we don't want to do that. Anyways, my name is Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, and broadcasting from Detroit, Michigan. I said what state, didn't I? In the upper Midwest. The program is Night Call. And our phone number, because we're a phone-in talk show, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. If you'd like to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short emails are the best if you'd like me to read them while I'm on the air. That is even like during breaks, being able to see what's up there. If it's a long message, it's pretty tough to do. My webpage, peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E, again, peterwerby.com, and we have a chat room for you. And I guess there's not a great number of people take part in, but quite a bit. Maybe one of you chatters could email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com and tell me whether we're getting some people in there. The chat room is where you discuss among yourselves what's going on. You have to go, it's odd, kind of an odd deal, too. You go to TomHartman.com, and then you got to get in his chat room, and we hitchhike on that for the broadcast. Happy Mother's Day to all that this applies to. I hope everyone has had a good day. And, of course, this is the day where we honor our mothers, the women that have brought forth the next generation, including us and whatever. And the woman who put it together, who first made the original Mother's Day proclamation way back in 1870, was Julia Ward Howe. You may know her for having written the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic in 1862. She was an anti-slavery activist. So she goes way back, and so does this holiday. By the way, thanks to Sid, who's listening in Oregon, for sending me this. Now, the original proclamation was an impassioned call for peace and disarmament. Actually, Julia Ward Howe, at the end of her life, bemoaned the fact that it had turned into a holiday of cards and flowers, because she had much greater purposes in mind. In the years following the Civil War, her political activism increased, as did her condemnation of war. And here are a few of the words to the original Mother's Day proclamation. This is the words of Julia Ward Howe. This is not the kind of Mother's Day proclamation that would issue forth from the White House today. She says, "Arise then, women of this day, arise all women who have hearts. Say firmly, we will not have questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking of carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be too tender to those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of a devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor," she says. And says in the end, "In the name of womanhood and humanity, I earnestly ask that a General Congress of Women without limit of nationality be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient at the earliest period consistent with its objectives to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interests of peace." This is the origins of Mother's Day. Now, this certainly isn't coming forth from the White House. In fact, what in the world is going on with George W. Bush's trip to Eastern Europe, the Baltics, and Russia? I mean, did he just go over there to cause trouble? He went over, as you may know, to the Baltic countries that were formerly, forcibly, part of the old Soviet Union, and began lecturing President Putin of Russia. And now, he says, this was from the Netherlands, Bush used the 60th anniversary of Nazi Germany's defeat to warn President Vladimir Putin of Russia on Saturday that no good purpose is served by stirring up fears and exploiting old rivalries. Now, you could just stop there and say, yeah, so why are you doing this? Why are you, like, picking this fight with Putin and Russia, which has atomic weapons, that has all sorts of people in the shadows of Russia that see the United States still as their grand enemy? And because of Bush's refusal to examine full and complete nuclear disarmament, we are still on a razor's edge of danger for a nuclear exchange. It ain't all over, folks, just because the Soviet Union is gone. Russia still has plenty of nukes. They wanted to get rid of them. They wanted the U.S. to similarly reduce the nuclear arsenal that we all have. Bush says no. In fact, they're talking about a new generation of nuclear weapons. Now, Bush going to the Baltic countries and condemning the Soviet occupation of those countries during the era of the Soviet Union is nothing but a provocation. It would be like Putin coming to Mexico and start talking about how the United States had stolen all of this land from Mexico. You know, California and Arizona, New Mexico and Texas and what have you. How do you think that would play here? Putin's in Mexico saying, yes, on this holiday, and then there's a number of events, the May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, when the Mexicans had won this big battle against the French. This was an attempt for the Europeans to recolonize the United States when we were involved in our own miserable little civil war. But think about that. If Putin was over in Mexico City reminding the Mexicans that they had all this land stolen from them. And believe it, the Mexican people have not forgotten about this. They don't talk about it much. It's not when President Fox or anything like that says is going to bring it up or anything like that. But it's there. So what possible purpose had he in doing that? Now, when he was also in that area, he also said something really, really, really peculiar. And this is what the headline says. U.S. had a hand in European divisions. Now, I'll tell you what that means. Now, this, stick with me with this, okay? Because this is a little strange, and it's not something that's at the tip of everyone's tongue or what we're really thinking about. But here's the way the Yahoo article starts. Maybe that'd be the best way, because they're talking to an audience that isn't entirely familiar with this subject, and you might not be either. second-guessing Franklin D. Roosevelt. President Bush said Saturday, the United States played a role in Europe's painful division after World War II, a decision that helped cause, quote, one of the greatest wrongs of history, close quote, when the Soviet Union imposed harsh rule across Central and Eastern Europe. Now, this is true. Now, here's the way it goes on. Bush said the lessons of the past will not be forgotten as the United States tries to spread freedom in the Middle East. Man, that's a load of crap. But anyways, Bush says we will not repeat the mistakes of other generations appeasing or excusing tyranny and sacrificing freedom in the vain pursuit of stability. And he goes on. Now, what's he talking about? And why is he talking about? This man, I mean, he's you know, we've established over the years, he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he has an agenda. It's a far-right wing agenda, and it's both nationally and internationally on the march. Even though his popularity is pretty low, it's not going to stop him because they know that at any point, remember, I don't know if you read my website, but it says, look out for another crisis being manufactured. Because whenever Bush gets in trouble, all of a sudden something happens. Now, here's what it's all about. Here's what it goes down to. Bush singled out the 1945 Yalta Agreement signed by Roosevelt in a speech opening a four-day trip focused on Monday's celebration in Moscow of the 60th anniversary of Nazi Germany's defeat. All right, the important part of it is Bush singled out the 1945 Yalta Agreement. So I suspect, maybe I'm wrong about you, and I'm sorry if I'm making any assumptions about you as an audience, but why do I suspect that probably 90% of you are searching their brains, Yalta? But it almost sounds like, you know, after you drank too much, Yalta, you know, or something. Excuse me, that's kind of ethnically stupid. But, you know, it doesn't even probably register with most people, 1945. Well, what happened was, well, here, it says, while history does not hide the U.S. role in Europe's division, American presidents have found little reason to discuss it before Bush's speech. Now, historian Alan Brinkley says, certainly it goes further than any president has gone. This has been a very common view of the far right for many years, that Yalta was a betrayal of freedom, that Roosevelt betrayed the hopes of generations. Bush said the Yalta Agreement, also signed by Britain's Winston Churchill, of course the darling of the conservatives, who knew how to deal with Iraqis when the Iraqi, when that was a English colony in the early 20s, Churchill, that wonderful lover of freedom, simply ordered his troops to use poison gas on Iraqi tribesmen. Anyways, the Yalta Agreement was signed by Churchill and the Soviet Union's Joseph Stalin, the dictator. And it followed in the, quote, unjust tradition of other infamous war pacts that carved up the continent and left millions in oppression. That's what Bush is saying. The Yalta Accord gave Stalin control of the whole of Eastern Europe, leading to criticism that Roosevelt had delivered millions of people to communist domination. Now, again, this has some modicum of truth to it, all right? There was this conference. Now, we hear this phrase in other regions and other times, facts on the ground. The facts on the ground is that the Soviet Union practically, for all practical purposes, defeated the Wehrmacht, defeated the Nazi war machine. Remember, the United States didn't even come into it till what was it, June of 1944. The Soviets had fought the Nazis since 1939, when their little deal with them fell through. I mean, you know, we're talking about two despicable governments, but at least one was our ally. Stalin was our ally. The Soviet Union was our ally. They fought these enormous battles. I mean, I think all of you know that Stalingrad and other places. The total losses, remember, for the United States, and I'm saying this off the top of my head, if anybody's got, you know, facts, if I'm a little off or something, if I'm, you know, if I'm way off, tell me. I think the United States in World War II lost 440,000 troops, the majority of them in the war against Japan. On the other hand, the Soviet Union lost 27 million people, 27 million soldiers and citizens. It's inconceivable for us. I mean, 440,000. I mean, we still haven't recovered from Vietnam, where we lost close to 60,000. Now, World War II, 440,000. Soviet Union, 27 million people fighting the Nazis. And they had advanced through innumerable countries, several of which had, in fact, been allied with the Nazis. And the Soviet Union felt... And I'm not, this is their explanation. I'm not even, no country has the right to dominate another. Because that they had sacrificed such, that they were due hegemony, control, dominance in that region. And this was agreed to by Winston Churchill. It was agreed to by Franklin Roosevelt. In many ways, they didn't have much choice because the Red Army had advanced pretty much to the boundaries of where it wound up. But the fact that Roosevelt betrayed these tens of millions to the communists was a central theme of the far, far, far right wing. I'm talking about the whacked out, insane anti-communists, the John Birch Society, people like that, if that means anything in this day and age. It doesn't get any more far right. I mean, fascistic. I mean, this was the claim essentially of the fascist right. Now, all of a sudden, George W. Bush is resurrecting this charge that the last time it was publicly uttered was by Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, the man who was finally had to leave the Senate in disgrace, or was at least chastised by the Senate for the disgrace he brought upon that body. So why all of a sudden George Bush attacking the memory of Franklin Delano Roosevelt? Okay, that's a tough one. That's a real tough one. Well, here's what I see, and if you want to comment on this, tell me. Franklin Delano Roosevelt is seen by the far right wing, of which George Bush is part of, as being the fount, the beginning of what they call socialism or the welfare state or whatever. Franklin Roosevelt received the country in shambles from a series of Republican presidents who presided over a situation uncomfortably very much like we're in today. You know, great people were doing poorly in many ways, but the middle class is getting squeezed. Stocks were expanding at an incredible rate, and then it all turned out to be a whole house of cards. Well, what these people are after is a right-wing revolution. They want to destroy the foundation of what was called Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. The whole idea of social democracy, that the government has a role in providing safety nets, that if you have a country where the distribution of income is so badly set up that you have tens of millions of poor people that have to depend on things like food stamps and housing subsidies and unemployment insurance and social security, well, they're getting at it in any number of ways. They're attacking it in any number of ways because that's what it's all about. They want to take us back to the 1890s. They're going to destroy the wage standards. They're going to destroy all the safety standards. This is going to be the robber barons' return. We're going to get to more of that as we continue into the show. So that's what this is all about. So, I mean, I think most of this slipped beneath the radar. But these aren't little incidentals. When Bush talks, there's always a purpose. There's always a purpose. One is political, which is to erode continually the basis of the Democratic Party in terms of its votes, but also to destroy the elements of civil society that pick up the slack where it needs to be, so that we're going to have a situation where the elderly aren't going to be paid for by Medicare in homes for the aged anymore, where people on disability are having their funds cut, where food stamps for the poor are having their funds cut. All the while, wealth continues to accrue to the already wealthy. The greedy, not the needy, I think, as Reagan said. Well, I mean, I see, and I don't know what you would respond. This is not a hot button topic. What is Runaway Bride? I think that's, or has that gone by already as well? Are we back to the Michael Jackson case? Anything to not have to examine by the media, which is coming in even lower in Congress now in terms of respect. But your comments at 313-298-WRIF. I wonder if my friend is listening. She insisted that I tell everything in such a discursive manner, so confusingly and coming out of my basic ADD that nobody would be able to understand that. Well, I hope she's wrong. Here's some of the news. This is just terrible. And I think I may have said this on the air before. I had this feeling of guilt, which I mean I rarely experience in my life, or rarely, certainly not in political matters. But I have this counter on my website at peterwerby.com that indicates, just so we know this all the time, how many American servicemen have died. I mean, I wish I had an exact count for how many Iraqi civilians have been killed as well by our forces, but it's not available. As Tommy Franks said, General Franks, we don't do body counts. Well, 1,600 service members have been killed in Iraq, 7 over the weekend. And what I, oh, the guilt. The guilt is putting it up there as figures and having it there to some extent as a political statement. This is what this illegal and useless and vicious, brutal war has done to our servicemen and women. And yet, when I go to that and I click on it, and there's a list, a CNN list, and it's the same man. Actually, I should even know his name by memory because it begins with an A. And all of a sudden, I start going down this list and seeing these faces of these young people and increasingly not so young people. I mean, you see people losing their lives, American soldiers in their 40s and their 50s. And I realize these are human beings that are connected in the most profound way to mothers. This is what Julia Ward Howe was talking about with her original Mother's Day proclamation about the sons of mothers who die in these stupid wars that never had to be fought. The vast majority of wars never should have been fought. Anyways, an explosion of insurgent violence in Iraq killed 7 U.S. service members over the weekend, even as the Shiite-dominated parliament reached out. Could I get people that are writing never to use that stupid phrase, reached out Sunday to Sunni Arabs? More than 300 people, including American forces, have been killed in a torrent of insurgent attacks since the cabinet was sworn in April 28th. 3 of the U.S. victims were soldiers killed Sunday in bombings in central Iraq. 1 soldier was killed and a second was wounded during an attack on a patrol near Samarra. 2 others died in an explosion 75 miles west of Baghdad. On Saturday, 3 U.S. Marines and a sailor were killed in fighting with insurgents in western Iraq. So these aren't like sneak attacks. These are military assaults. So things aren't exactly going swimmingly there, are they? In fact, most people overwhelmingly say now that it is not. Most in the U.S. say Iraq war is not worthwhile. According to CNN, a majority of Americans do not believe it was worth going to war in Iraq, according to a national poll released on Tuesday. 57% of us polled said they did not believe it was worth going to war versus 41% who said it was. What could possibly motivate this 41% after looking at this carnage that is so far beyond me? That was a drop in support from February when 48% said it was worth going to war and 50% said it was not. 42% said, asked how things were going in Iraq. 56% said badly or very badly. 42% said well or very well. 42% of the people think that things are going well or very well in Iraq? Are they on a different planet than most of us? I'll tell you who some of these people are. I mean, I don't know what motivates them, but some of them are these ideological creeps, these far-right-wing conservatives, some of them young. And I have on my website, you may want to take a look at this, I talk about the mixing here of images. There, and I don't have any link to it because I wouldn't give these people any publicity. But it's a website which has pro-war gear, including this little cut that I have on mine that I can't make out what image it is, but it's a very, very skimpy halter top for a woman and a very low cut or cut in from the sides and cut in across the stomach or whatever the hell, that part of your body right below a woman's breasts. They just call it like a bodice or something, B-O-D-I-C-E or something like that. And the woman is in the act, well, could be coming up, but suggestively pulling down her jeans till they're almost at the level of her genitals. So, and her head's cut off, I mean, in the photo. So here's what you see. You see this this tank top on a woman with fair-sized breasts that says pro-war across them, and she is lowering her pants. This is sick, folks. And particularly a lot of these young conservatives, they're really a pack of sickos. They're really a pack of sickos. So I wrote them. I thought I'd get some stiff letter back from them. I said, wouldn't it be more appropriate for you young, and the woman is obviously young, you can tell from the shape of her body, wouldn't it be more appropriate for you young people who support the war to be in camo rather than in some oh-so-hip tank top that says pro-war? We've got young men and women over there. They're going to come back with no faces or no legs or no intestines or not exist any longer while you root them on. Is there anything lower than that? Well, they ever seen statements from, well, I want to finish my studies and I think I can contribute to the country by getting my MBA. I mean, really, they say things like this. All the while, they're cheering on the troops that are killing and being killed. They really are reprehensible, aren't they? Or I don't know. Are you there? I mean, do you have something to say for yourself? I don't know. All right. Peter Werby here with you at 313-298-WRIF and calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Let's go to our first caller. I think we have everything fixed in terms of our levels and all that. This is Richard in Clawson. Richard, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How are you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Excellent. Hold on 1 second.
What do I have to do?
Okay. I just wanted to cut off the radio.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I just had kind of an observation, and I'm going to leave it with a question for you.
Sure.
From what I've observed around me, just the vast majority of the population pretty much sees one basic news message throughout the mainstream media, be it the newspapers, certainly all of cable television, and the AM radio. So they pretty much get the same message constantly.
Oh, you mean if there's a particular issue like the runaway bride?
Take any issue,
yeah.
Any issue from the war on drugs to the so-called war on terror, everything. Just has such a consistent, repeating, brainwashing message that's really devoid of substantive facts.
Okay, I agree, but how come then, I mean, I could answer this, but you were going to ask me a question. Yeah. I'll ask you a question, Richard. How come you're not affected by this?
That is such an interesting question, Peter. I personally believe it comes down to levels of awareness within the individual.
Okay.
And at that lower level, we would have people that are more, they're very easily black or white. You know, they're us against them. They have a very fearful view of existence, and that channels them directly toward the kind of leadership that we see in many places around the world, and certainly here more than ever. And then you have people with higher levels of consciousness toward, you know, being able to look at things like, you know, look at it objectively, look at a historical context, and you can see that at any given time when there's a crisis or a war, the government's lying about everything.
Yeah, that's, I don't know if I ever told you, my wife's a little dictum. She says if they're on television and they have a suit on, they're lying.
Well, right, and anybody that really looks at history, you know, you know what I'm saying? It would lead you to that awareness.
Well, let me just tell you, I mean, I don't know how much time you watch television, but I always mention that I never watch television. I'm in the business of getting information, finding out about the news, and if I thought that television news, either the networks or the cables, contained useful information about the news and about analysis and stuff I could really use, I'd be watching it 2 or 3 hours a day. I don't watch it 2 hours a week.
Well, I think for the most part, television, we don't even need it because there's nothing good on it. Actually, we could use it for something good, but it's really, there's not much on there. I feel kind of kind of a social duty in a way, even a spiritual duty to, okay, on a regular basis, just sample, okay, what are they saying on Fox News?
I mean, it's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it.
Yeah, just so I can see.
Okay, you know what? Yeah. You're still doing them a favor. I mean, I think television is very useful for the Piston Pacers playoffs, for Seinfeld reruns, for, you know, Letterman when you're not going to bed. You don't want to read.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's all fine.
Well, you know, people say it's mindless entertainment. That, for that kind of, you know, for humor or for sports or stuff like that, unfortunately, it's equally mindless for the news.
Oh, without a doubt. It's just formulaic. They're just part of, they're a cog in this trinity between, you know, huge corporations, the government, the military, oil, and media. Now they're all one.
Yeah, well, I've always made the point that sooner or later we're going to be run by a company called, or everything in the world is going to be sold and by International General, and it'll probably be administered by the Waltons. All right, Richard, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I should move on. And where should we go next? We'll go here. Here's Rick from Detroit. Rick, hi, it's Peter Werby. Rick? Rick, what's happening, man? You got a lot of noise going on there.
Sorry about that. Let me see if I can get this window up a little bit. Can you
okay.
hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Got my earpiece out. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello?
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can barely hear you. I better call you back from a land.
Okay. All right. Call us back. Let's do a spots, and we'll be right back to get your calls on WRIM.
This is WRIM.com.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy? A lot of squinting going on? Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up? Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-M-O-R. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center. The most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877, you see more. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877, you see more. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds. I'll see you.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening, or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants. Like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
Listening to WRIF.com. with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. We're kicking around a number of ideas. Please join us, 313-298-WRIF. I was talking about Bush's trip to Eastern Europe and why he was picking a fight with Russia. He met with Putin. Why do I keep saying Putin? Putin. I don't know. How the hell do you say it? I mean, I usually hear Putin. Picking a fight with Putin. And then they made up. They made up. But what was left, essentially? I mean, one wonders why Bush even went over there. I mean, supposedly for this commemoration. But going over to these countries and lecturing them about democracy is a little strange, given the 2000 election, given the whole problem with the voting machines here in the United States. I mean, that takes a lot of arrogance. In fact, Putin kind of threw that back in his face, like, hey, you know, when here in Russia, the guy that gets the most votes wins. That didn't happen in 2000, so you know, pretty much saying, take your advice and shove it. Now, Bush, though, went for the far right-wing fascist argument that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had turned Eastern Europe over to Stalin and the Soviet Union after 1945. Stock and trade charges from the far right wing from probably 1945 through, I don't know, maybe the 70s or something, finally faded away. There wasn't much option that FDR had. The massive Red Army had defeated the Nazi armies, the Wehrmacht. And here is what, let's see, Gertie writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I think the comment was part of the fight, with the fight Bush is trying to apparently pick with Russia. Pretty much, quote, we, Roosevelt, made a mistake to let you control Eastern Europe. So if Bush was there, he would not have let Russia take anything. So Bush's idea that would have prolonged the Second World War, which is true, that there... Stalin had a lot of cards. He had the facts on the ground. But what's really at issue here isn't so much some criticism from 60 years ago, but rather the attempt of the far right wing now to discredit Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and with that, all the programs that he brought about to bring the United States out of the Depression. In fact, I mean, they didn't even... I mean, that's another story. They didn't even all work. But we brought with it the right to organize unions, Social Security, any number of other programs that say, hey, that we live in a community, and if everybody isn't doing real well, well, maybe the government ought to be there to help. That we shouldn't let elderly people be left to their own resources or the vagaries of the market. You know, maybe that if people are elderly and can't fend for themselves, that there ought to be money for Medicare, which that's where the real crisis is. It's a phony crisis with Social Security. You know, maybe that there ought to be assistance for housing and the food stamps for the poor. This is what Bush and company, Bush Co., want to get rid of. They want to turn our resources essentially over to the already wealthy and to the corporations. We'll get to more of that as we continue. All right, let's go to Mike. Mike is in Lincoln Park. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I was wondering, I got a couple questions for you.
Sure.
I really only started paying attention to this stuff since Bush has been in office and I've been getting laid off and stuff.
That'll do it.
So I was reading an ad in the Toledo paper a couple days ago about these people that work for the school district, not the teachers, but like janitors and things like that.
Yeah.
Was they've been without a contract for a couple of years now, and then their union notified, you know, whoever they had to notify about when they're going to go out on strike.
Mm-hmm.
So the school board had this emergency meeting, and they come back with giving the principal, the okay to fire everybody and hire in new people. Now, I think it started back in Reagan, but, I mean, what happened? Is there like a law that was passed that they can just fire people at will?
Well, if your union contract expires, you then become an at-will employee, unless there's legislation that prohibits that. But that's the way things are going. That's what happened to these janitors in a big building in downtown Detroit. People were making fairly decent wages, and these people decided, well, hey, we can contract it out to somebody that's getting $8 an hour. Let's do that. No benefits. And that's the way things are going.
Well, that's pretty obvious. I was just wondering, I thought, you know, did Reagan do something with the Did he make it like a law or something?
No, maybe someone.
Traffic controllers, you know?
Well, that was the opening shot. And these were people that were dumb enough, working people, union people that were dumb enough to actually back Reagan. And these people have no loyalty except to the wealthy and to the corporations. So here was a union that supported Reagan, and he destroyed it. And this is what they're all about. They're all about destroying the standard of living for the working class, but it's also destroying the middle class as well.
That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, listen, where was I? I was just thinking that every once in a while I see, these pricey stores and, new housing going up. In Detroit.
Everywhere.
Yeah, $300,000 townhouses in the Wayne State area, and I'm thinking, where?
That's so both the mom and the dad can work, and then the kids can get early jobs to help pay for it, too.
There you go.
But my next question was, how would somebody that's not on the Internet get a hold of information like this, or maybe like bumper stickers and just information in general?
Well, I'll tell you, it has become a lot more difficult these days to not, I almost depend exclusively on the Internet. I mean, there's some magazines out there, things like, I can't remember, like the Progressive magazine, another one called In These Times, but they come out like monthly. And what happens is that if you watch the nightly news, if you watch the cables, they're just there with all the BS. And unless you have a lot of access to contrary material or have a background in all this, you're thinking, wow.
Yeah, the only thing I really get my information from is you and C-SPAN. I watch C-SPAN sometimes, and
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I mean, the assumption should not be made by people like me that everyone has the Internet, because the Internet and computers, another way to get our money, to keep us sitting in front of a screen. And you notice I didn't say go out and get one.
Right.
The other thing is go down to where you're in Lincoln Park. Go down to Lincoln Park Library. You can log on there, and if you don't know how to do it, they'll teach you how to do it.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah.
I was even thinking maybe getting the monthly magazines at maybe like a bookstore or something, I guess.
Sure, you can do that. And like I said, if you get a little computer savvy and the librarians will help you, you can often start. I mean, and this doesn't do anything for me. If you go to my website, that links you into like a lot of news sources where I get my information from.
Okay. Like out of country news and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mike.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Good luck on it. And it's that kind of knowledge that you have to be engaged in order to make sense of this. What's going on in our country. If you don't, if you just superficially read the headline or one of those like 175-word stories in the Detroit News, or you just get a glance at what the crawler across the bottom of the cables, I mean, at least do yourself and the rest of us a favor and don't make any strong, give forth with any strong opinions based on that or let it influence you, because there's not enough there. There really isn't. There's some open lines, though, at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Bill. Bill's calling from Adrian. Hi, you're on the air. Well, let's see. I guess. Oh, I see. Okay. Go ahead, Bill. You're on the air.
How's it going?
Going great.
I think that my biggest concern that I've heard tonight was earlier we were talking, or I heard you speaking about the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a pretty moderate person. I'm really not a conservative nor a liberal. I kind of take the view of whoever has the closest views to myself, I guess. But I think that the most rhetoric I've ever heard within the past 6 months, year to a year and a half of the Iraq war is I think that most people forget that it was not only the right-wing conservatives as well as left-wing liberals voted for this war. I think it came across both tables. The Democrats seen the exact same intelligence reports that President Bush saw, as well as right-wing conservatives. And for some reason, the American Republic has, or the American public has forgotten that.
Well, that's not entirely true. I mean, the John Kerrys and the John Edwards and the Hillary Clintons voted for the war to their shame, but both senators from Michigan voted against it. I don't remember if the House, the House voted as well, and I believe all but one of the Michigan members of the House of Representatives voted against it.
Absolutely, I agree with you on that. But I think that what we forget is the majority of the Democrats, as well as the majority of the Republicans, voted for it. And I'm not saying that we went in there with the best intentions. I'm not saying that, obviously, the intelligence reports that the administration had were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the chemical and biological weapons of mass destruction that we thought that they did. But as a person who has a brother that's been over there for the past 3 years, as well as my brother was also in Afghanistan, I just get so tired of hearing all the garbage. You know, it almost seems like we forget that we have the young men and women over there doing the job that they were asked to do.
What's the solution? I mean, my little slogan is support our troops, bring them home. I mean, our troops and our efforts there have done enormous damage to the people of that country, to the culture and that society, and they've paid a price as well. I mean, do we just want to continue?
You know what? There's absolutely no doubt that they have paid a tremendous price, the people of that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we can sit here and we can argue about how there is a tyranny and the whole nine yards until we're all blue in the face, and we'll never get anywhere with that.
Right.
But I feel that if we were to pull out right now, you know, I've heard this so many times, let's just get our troops home, let's just get our troops home. But if we were to pull out at this point in time, I really honestly feel that we'd be doing nothing more than providing another Afghanistan breeding ground for more terrorists for the future.
Well, Bill, doesn't it seem like that's what it is now?
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah.
We've got to stay the course. I know we've heard this so many times from President Bush. And I'm not trying to be this huge Bush backer. That's not what I'm trying to do.
I got you. Yeah.
But we have to. There's no choice about it right now, Pete. We have to do that.
Well, I think, like Vietnam, that it's not going to be a matter of a choosing, or it might be, like Vietnam, where the majority of people now are opposed to the war, think that we never should have entered it, that the Congress, like it did in Vietnam, eventually realized that the United States couldn't afford this war. And we see the economic damage, if we only want to look at even just selfishly, what's happened to our society, and that we've spent $300 billion. It's been great for Wall Street and, you know, the Halliburtons and the Bechtels and all that, but it's been disastrous for us as well.
Oh, I agree with you on that point. But the unfortunate thing is, Pete, is that unlike Vietnam, when we left Vietnam, the worst thing that happened there was that the communists took over. But unfortunately, with Iraq, we cannot afford to let Al-Qaeda or these other multitudes of terrorist groups take over there.
Well, then I always say, and it sounds like an unfair question, and no one who I've asked this to has ever answered me, how many American deaths are we willing to take of our sons and daughters and neighbors and community members? How many Iraqis are we willing to kill? And how much of our fortune are we willing to expend on that effort? Endless?
I will absolutely, and I feel this, and I'll absolute, Pete. I will tell you exactly what my brother told me. You know what? It, unfortunately, and I don't mean to sound so harsh. I really honestly don't, because, you know, I feel for every, as a person who has a brother over there, I feel for every American family that has a son, a daughter, mm-hmm. a mother, or a father over there.
Go ahead.
At this point in time right now, with how dangerous it is, and the glass that we are treading on at this point in time, it doesn't matter. We have to stay the course.
So if it was 10,000 or 20,000 and we spent another $300 billion, that's what we have to do because the stakes are so high.
Pete, we lost 58, over 58,000
troops. Yeah, almost 60,000.
We lost over 58,000 troops in Vietnam. And I'm going to tell you, and I hate to say this, I don't mean to sound like...
Go ahead, just tell me, though, because we're kind of running out of time.
If I'll tell you right now, if it took 50,000 troops, that's what we have to do. We've seen the consequences of 9/11, and I'm telling you, we can't go through it again.
Okay. All right. Let's leave it at that. Thank you. Appreciate it, Bill. So Bill says, whatever the cost, how many lives we expend, how much money, how many Iraqis, because it's connected up to September 11th. Hmm. Jim from South Lyon probably wouldn't like my response there, but thank you for writing. Anyways, he says, I've been listening to your talk show for about the last 10 years. My only criticism is that you are too nice to Republicans, although Bill said he was neither, not a liberal or a conservative. They are out to destroy our way of life, and if we do nothing to stop them, we will feel the repercussions for generations to come. I believe that. Although I think here was just a difference of opinion. Part of this came about because, I can't remember his name, from Ann Arbor, said that my website, PeterWerby.com, was too extreme, too radical, too, because there was like this Hitlerian imagery for Bush. Chris from Gross Point writes, I'm not a fan of your website. I think the caller that everyone trashed meant to say that you sound much smarter on the show, at least I think you do. Well, you know, I'll put a lot of over-the-top stuff on my website. I'm not going to say, you know, on the, some talk show hosts do say, you know, Bush is a Nazi or something like that. But I'll put stuff like that on my website. It's kind of a different medium, and man, I like to have fun with it. And I think political hyperbole, exaggeration, it's okay. I mean, so there's other websites if you don't like it. So am I too radical? This is Lonnie. He writes in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com. I listen from Tokyo on a somewhat regular basis over radiopower.org. For what it's worth, I don't think you're too anything. Common sense and simple logic seems to be your approach. Well, thank you. He also says, the uniform and misinformed are collectively leading us into disasters unimaginable. These same uninformed and misinformed will zealously follow those liars of empire that will point the finger of blame instead of questioning the ambitions of empire. He says, by the way, I was drafted in 68 and fought in Vietnam. I'm a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War and VAIW. Veteran, I don't know what that is. Okay. Anyway, is that it? Yeah, for that. So, I don't know. Maybe you can look at my website and decide for yourself. Let's go to Al in Detroit. Been waiting patiently. Al, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thank you for waiting.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Doing good.
Peter, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Yeah, I got two questions. Number one, I want to ask you something about basically social conservatives, theocrats that are in power right now. Do you think, given the sheer number, and I think there are a lot of them, more than we hope, and do you think, given their sheer number and the power that they have, the Democrats can actually ignore all their demands? I mean, I don't think that's happening. I mean, they are moving really close to overturning Roe v. Wade. I think they might be successful in the next few years. Look at homosexual rights. You know, we're not going to have gay marriage anytime soon in this country. And the few rights that the homosexual community does have, they're going after those, too.
They are indeed. Well,
can the Democrats actually win elections without...
Well, I don't know. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the Democrats won the 2000 election, and there's some good evidence to show that they may, in fact, have won the 2004 election as well. But that they're so passive, they're so meek, they're so timid that when elections are stolen out from under them, or at least there's in the 2004, there's a possibility with all the shenanigans in Ohio and the paperless voting machines that were the companies owned by Republicans, that they do or say nothing. I don't think it's even so much ideology as a lack of will. I mean, they're not used to being an opposition party. They're just the Democrats have always just been the other side of the racket. That they were somewhat different, a little more liberal, a little more tied into human rights and civil rights and labor unions and what have you. So they were marginally better than the Republicans. But and they expected the racket to go along exactly as it did. They didn't know that it was going to veer off so far to the right. And that there was going to be I mean, fascistic sounds so it sounds like that hyperbole I was talking about, but this corporatist America where corporations, and that's essentially what fascism is, but this corporatism where it's just everyone is left to their own resources, and when that occurs, generally, at least two-thirds of a population, as we can look in other countries, ones to the south of us, like Mexico and what have you, the two-thirds of the people don't do very well at all. So what it's really about is not the Democratic Party, because they've never shown any will whatsoever to combat, either to combat the far right wing, as you may remember from history from the 50s as well, or have they ever led dramatically in terms of social change when they've been pushed along. When they've been pushed along as they were in the 30s under Roosevelt or Johnson in the 1960s, then they'll do something. But people have always taken the lead, and as long as we're, as a people, sitting passively, listlessly, hoping that somebody like John Kerry or Hillary in 2008 is going to change things for us, we're really in dreamland.
My argument is that the Democrats or the liberals, progressives, never lost the arguments on things like minimum wage and on issues such as health care. I think they lost the argument when it comes to religion. I mean, the South turned against the progressive movement basically because of cultural issues such as guns, abortion. These are issues that we never confronted. Democrats are now changing their stances on abortion. They're changing their stances on gun rights, especially a lot of Southern conservative senators who happen to be part of the Democratic Party. They're standing up for gun rights now. So, I think the Democrats have to listen to some of these social conservatives.
Well, maybe, but I think it's kind of the squeaky wheel getting the grease. And I think that that if when you start going down the list of progressive ideas, American people overwhelmingly support them. It's the far right wing is heavily financed by wealthy nutballs and corporations, mostly corporations, but also some individual right wing wackos. And they have been able to take this ideological, religiously driven core and done immense amount of successes, where the progressive left, although there's millions of people in it, tens of millions of people, many of us organized into groups and churches, liberal churches and unions, just don't have the drive, just don't have the ideological fervor that these right-wing revolutionaries have. And right-wing revolution is always fascist. All right, thank you. I got to go. Got to do a little business before midnight here in Detroit. We will be right back. Thanks for calling.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hit the great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment, located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings, like Buddy's Pizza. Come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com. Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever, on your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money and that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's Spring 2005 semester. Final walk-in registration for spring classes is May 5th and 6th. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's five convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is May 5th and 6th. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Classes begin May 9th.
Sink to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rigs across Detroit with a three-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
Rip rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Hey, you know, I should have been talking about this right from the beginning. My guest at 1 a.m. is going to be Ron Kovic. Ron Kovic, the author of Born on the 4th of July. You may know of the book. Maybe a lot more people know about the, I can't think of his name, Stone. Oliver, yeah. Oliver Stone movie of the same name starring Tom Cruise as the paraplegic anti-war vet who was wounded. Second tour of duty as a Marine, Ron Kovic, when he got shot, never walked again, and he's been an anti-war activist ever since. And there's a new edition of his book out. So that will be at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Welcome to the broadcast if you're just joining us. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. Email calltalkyes at yahoo.com and my website peterwerbe.com. Yeah, I had way over 350,000 hits on it, and then all of a sudden it went to zero. So I don't know what the hell's happening now. By the way, we had a call from Bill of from Adrian, who has a brother in Iraq, and he said we can't pull out, that we have to take whatever casualties come about. Now, according to friends in the Tom Hartman chat room, over 1,600. I guess it's 1,601. He said we lost almost 60,000, Bill did, 60,000 in Vietnam, and of course we lost there. We lost miserably. We killed 3 million Vietnamese, so in terms of body counts that the U.S. was so famous for then, and that's one of the reasons why General Tommy Franks said we don't do body counts, because it was so bad. It reflected so badly on the U.S. And same thing, that country was just destroyed. The chemical warfare used, this Agent Orange that hurt so many GIs, that the United States has always denied, by the way, is still causing birth defects in Vietnamese children today. Now, Daryl from Sterling Heights writes into calltalkyes at yahoo.com. He says, I wish we could pull all the troops out now, but that cannot be the first step. The first step is to resolving the problem in Iraq is accountability in regards to the U.S. Admit to the wrongs and the lies, put our leaders on trial for war crimes, he says, and then put someone in charge that genuinely not only has not only the United States' best interest in mind, but also that of the entire world. That is the first step that will stop the violence, and then we can bring the troops home. Yeah, we owe these people. The United States, under George Bush, illegally invaded that country on the basis of lies. And unfortunately, we're still going to have to clean up that mess. I say unfortunately because so much damage was done, and we're going to have to pay for it, you and I, out of our tax dollars. And we've got to work out a way, though, so that we're not being built by Bush's friends that, on one hand, that have destroyed the war. Tom from Ann Arbor writes in because the caller, Bill from Adrian, said that the intelligence that Bush had, that the Democrats saw, is what led them to support the war resolution. He said also the majority of Democrats supported it. I don't think they did. I think it was like 37 Democrats were opposed to it, and it's really good to know that Carl Levin and Debbie Stabenow from Michigan voted against it in the Senate. But he being Tom, says, just to set the record straight, the administration had the right intelligence. They chose to ignore it. That's right. I mean, I count on you people so much. I mean, Bush knew, like I knew, and great numbers of you listening knew, that there were no weapons of mass destruction. That it was a total lie, that it was a manufactured crisis to raise Bush's popularity and to have us ignore the Enron scandal. Hey, remember that? Yeah. Tom writes in, the intelligence provided by the CIA, Department of State, and Internal Defense Department, Middle Eastern experts, foreign intelligence services, the reports from the UN arms inspectors all indicated there were no weapons of mass destruction. You're absolutely right, Tom, because I knew that. That's, I mean, I wasn't there, but knowing all that and a lot of independent information, history of UN previous UN inspections and UN inspectors, one knew. If you wanted to know, if you weren't involved in willful ignorance, the way the media was that sold the lies that the liars in the Bush administration put forth that has led to all this death and destruction, you could have known. And he says, this administration lied, 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 period. This is what the official British government memo leaked to the Times of London shows this to be the case, that they chose to ignore the intelligence. It was a rigged job from the beginning. And that's why the bumper sticker, the signs, Bush lied, people died, is so relevant still today. And we tend to ignore this, the fact that people are continuing to die in this slaughter gate. Remember they had like all these, what do they call it with Clinton? I can't remember what it was. Watergate was Nixon. Boy, I'm really losing it. But anyway, and Tom, I should tell you, in Ann Arbor, that I finally bought a good music hall, the brand name Turntable. Thanks for your advice. He says, sorry about the rant, but this is too damn important to just ignore. We can't let the racketeers of the right create a 21st century memory hole. Remember, memory hole was what there was in 1984. Well, yeah, that's exactly what the right wing is involved in, and the media just helps them along. Let's go to Maurice in Inkster. Maurice, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Peter?
I'm doing well. Thank you, sir.
You know, I got something to say about the baseball commissioner, you know, giving these overpaid players three strikes.
Yeah.
So far as, I'm like this. You know what the game is? It goes for all sports athletes.
Wait, Maurice. Let's just tell people you don't want to reduce the number of actual strikes, but this is with steroids. And finally, you got to be caught three times before you'll actually get booted out of baseball.
My rule would be the first time you get caught, you're out of baseball for life. You know what the deal is? So you're going to try to cheat to make your record better so you can get a higher salary? No. Because, you know, when we took tests in school, we got caught cheating. We got put out of school, and we had to pay the price.
Well, what about just talk about drugs? What about illegal drugs? What if you get caught with marijuana in Inkster or Detroit or Southfield? You can say, well, wait a minute. This is just my first time. Wait till I get caught three times.
Same thing.
You're right.
You know, I'll tell you something. One of my worst-hated basketball players, Chris Webber, because a couple of years ago, he got caught with some weed before he scored him. You never heard nothing about it again.
You're right.
You know, I'm going to end this with a joke. All the top-paid players in the world, you know, different teams, tried to figure out why they didn't make no money last season. They found out from their accountants and lawyers they don't make no money when they're in drug rehab. You have a nice one there, Peter.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for calling in, Maurice. And we can stay in, all right, let's go to Okemos. That's way up by Lansing. And Peyton's been waiting patiently. Peyton, hi, you're on the air. What are you listening on, cable? Are you with me? Let's see. How come I don't hear anything? All right, I'm going to try putting this back on hold, and I'll just see, make sure that we have. Yeah, okay. Maybe he just gave up because Okemos is a long way away from Detroit. I think people can listen to it there on cable, though. It's well, we'll stay in Inkster. Go to Al. Al, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Bill says we're on thin ice, and his solution is build a bonfire.
In Iraq. I like that. You didn't make that up, did you?
Yes, I did.
Well, that's excellent.
I called because I had a moment of clarity.
What's that?
I went to school and I graduated from college in the 80s, and a lot of my friends worked on a loading dock as casuals.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got hired, you know, I lost a job, I just got hired back in, and I'm a casual. And I realized I'm on the same loading dock they worked on as a casual.
Wow.
And in 1988, they made $12 and change an hour. I'm making $9 an hour.
Well, what's the old phrase that I didn't make up? The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
And the wages are going down, and, you know, they say, okay, well, you know, we move the jobs overseas so we can build the stuff cheaper, but, you know, the price never gets any cheaper, does it?
Well, how about this one, Al? One of the main causes of crime is poverty, right?
I've been thinking about knocking over banks.
Well, I wasn't trying to make any suggestions here, but we know that that crime, particularly violent crime and what have you, are mostly a phenomena of the poor. That if you have an equitable society, if you don't have dirt poor people, if jobs are available and what have you, you have tremendously, tremendously less crime. So you have this country where structurally, that poverty is built into the equation. Even though it's the wealthiest country in the world, as we keep hearing, it proportionately has more poor people than any other country in the industrialized world. Okay, so the suburb I live in has had a lot of cutbacks in the wealthiest country in the world, and in its park services and the forestry and all this kind of stuff like this, just like most of the other cities have. And they've laid off lots of union people. So what happens is, what happened? Actually, during the weekend, I went to our city park with our dog, my wife and I, and there we see a busload of inmates cleaning up the park that used to be done by union members. So you see this kind of, it's kind of recycling, you know what I mean?
Coming in to do the work for free so they can pay their debt to society.
Yeah. I mean, it's volunteer. They say, do you want to sit in this cell all day? Do you want to go out and clean the park? And naturally, they say that. But that used to be a waged union job. And now, and because poverty and lack of jobs causes crime, it then circulates into it. The poor who now are working for free.
Actually paying because... Having been through and having administered, you know, those kind of programs as a volunteer probation officer, you have to pay to work.
You were a volunteer parole officer?
Yeah, they have that program.
Why would anybody want to be a volunteer parole officer? Was this, tell me before I make any bad guesses.
Well, I mentioned the moment of clarity, you know, and at the time I got arrested, I was arrested for drunk driving, and, you know, it caused me to make a choice, you know, do I love whiskey more than driving? And I said, no, I love to drive. So I gave up drinking, but I wasn't committed enough to the 12-step programs or AA enough to, you know, become a sponsor.
Uh-huh.
And a woman I did business with said, you know, well, I'm a volunteer PO, so I became a volunteer PO because I could work with, you know, the same people. You know, basically, you know, set a thief to catch a thief. I could work with people, you know, that had the same problems I had.
I mean, was
help
it...
Help them work through it.
Was it a charity, a sense of charity, or a sense of punitiveness?
Charity.
Okay.
I really tried to help
okay.
people.
That's good. That's good.
That was one of the big problems we had was, you know, people came in and they had serious drug and alcohol problems. But we didn't have a program to place them in. We didn't have rehab, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing you could do is, a lot of times you looked at them and said, you know, get arrested again.
Wow.
You get arrested again, you'll go to jail and you might be able to get some help.
Hmm. Thank you, Al. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Now, any militant form of any religion is dangerous. We always hear about militant Islam, right? And sure enough, I mean, going back to its invasion of Europe in before the 10th century, that's what that was all about. And then militant Christianity during the Crusades and its cooperation in the conquering of the New World and the butchering of millions and millions of people. And we're seeing a resurrection of both forms of militant Islam and militant Christianity. And we're all, we've seen the results of militant Islam, and we see these images that are portrayed so frequently and sort of like, you know, 3 minute hate in 1984. But we are also being subjected to this militant right-wing Christianity that's trying to completely reshape our culture, completely reshape our nation, even though they're this small minority. And remember, we were, oh, what were those people called? The divisionists? It couldn't be, because it couldn't be that, because that would they be about division? Anyways, they were talking about wanting to control the entire culture. Everything that we see, we read, that's present in public life. And so it's religio-fascism, essentially. And it's really making these inroads to all of these institutions in the United States. Listen to this. Air Force sets new inquiry at Academy. This is from the New York Times, May 5th. The Pentagon is sending investigators to the Air Force Academy to look into complaints that evangelical Christian faculty members, officers, and cadets, not everybody, routinely proselytize and intimidate those on campus who do not hold the same religious beliefs. Now, we may have been talking about this earlier. There was a Jewish cadet that was getting a real hard time. But this is not, these are people that are do not hold the same extreme right-wing evangelical views. Well, let me read on. The inquiry follows accusations that these other cadets have long been subject to a climate of religious intolerance. Another sign of fascism. To address the problem, the Academy in Colorado Springs began requiring its faculty and students in March to attend 50-minute sensitivity training classes. Okay. But last week, the advocacy group Americans United for Separation of Church and State sent a report to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld saying the problem remained and was systemic throughout the whole academy, in other words. Among the accusations are that cadets who declined to attend chapel after dinner were marched back to their dormitories in a procession called the Heathen Flight, that a history professor ordered students to pray before their final exam. In the 2 weeks after the religious sensitivity program was announced, the football coach placed a banner in the locker room that said, "I am a member of Team Jesus Christ." Now, this is not a religious school. This is the Air Force of the United States. This has been taken over lock, stock, and barrel by these far right-wing religious evangelicals. Barry Lynn, Reverend Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, says this is the worst systemic series of religious discriminatory acts I've ever seen in any federal government context. Well, I mean, this is pretty bad. This shouldn't be happening. This is a country with lots of religions and people with no religion. If you don't want to go to, I mean, imagine these people. They're going to daily chapel. I mean, which is their right. I mean, I don't care if these people live in chapel. I don't care if they pray 24 hours a day, including in their sleep. But when they start trying to force it down other people's throats, we know the consequences of militant organized religion. Always bad, always authoritarian, always accompanied by great social turmoil and death. There's never been a case where this hasn't occurred. Onward, Christian soldiers, right? Anyways, it turns out, so here is this extraordinarily religious military academy, except that this inquiry is the second major investigation of the academy in the last 2 years. What was the other one? Anybody remember? Well, the earlier one was undertaken after nearly 150 women there said they'd been sexually assaulted by fellow cadets. That investigation led to the replacement of the academy's top commanders. Well, maybe it's too broad a brush. They've been sexually assaulted by 150 women. Maybe it's by those ones that didn't go to chapel. Huh? You think so? I've got another. I want to get back to you, though, but I've got a inch-thick folder here of religious assaults on our secular society, and another one on conservative hypocrites. Maybe I'll at least do the conservative hypocrites. Hey, give us a call. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here in Fenton is Roger. Roger, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter? I haven't heard from you for a while. I've been working a lot more, you know, for less money, same old thing everyone else talking about.
Wow.
You know, because of our weapons of mass deception there. You know, talking about the religious stuff and that, they're starting to kick out church members. I was reading the paper today because they're not behind Bush there.
I saw that. Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, the guy's so out of touch. And what got me is, what, Earth Day was 2 weeks ago. I don't know if anyone commented. I haven't listened yet. You know, where did Bush go? Great Smoky Mountains, the most polluted place in the country. You know, he doesn't even know it. You know, he just don't get it.
Yeah, and the pollution pollution is getting worse, and it's getting worse because of the rollback of these environmental regulations on the part of Bush. In fact, I forgot to bring that story. Clinton, one of his last acts, and he should have done it 8 years before, was to put all of this wilderness off limits for any kind of development. Now, Bush is turning it over to Rhodes and the possibility of development. They say, well, you know, we're going to turn it over to the states and what have you. But previously, that the United States federal government could not take our tax money and destroy natural habitat by putting in roads that would benefit the oil or the energy companies, mining companies, and particularly the lumber companies. Lumber companies can only extract or destroy these forests. They extract resources. Destroy these forests, these natural habitat of wildlife, by us, the taxpayer, taking our money and spending hundreds of millions of dollars to build these roads. So these roads are built essentially. These roads are built essentially by us, the taxpayer, as a all of a sudden it's out of my mind. What do you call it? It's a giveaway to these big corporations.
Well, what they did too, Peter. Did you read last year $240 million to build these roads for the lumber company? Where'd the lumber go? It went to Japan at $1.40. Stuff that's worth $5,000 a tree.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't believe we subsidized this, and now we got oil companies. In the first 9 months of this year, the economist said it's like they got a money print machine, $98.4 billion in profit 9 months.
Actually,
where does it end?
Well, it doesn't. And also, let me see if I can grab this quickly. I don't know what happened to it, but there was another big Bush giveaway to the drug companies that allowed them to take profits from overseas, and instead of paying 35% on them, only having to pay 5%, because they said this would create American jobs. Well, of course, it created no American jobs whatsoever, and was this other huge windfall for the big drug companies that are soaking us, taking us to the cleaners on drug prices. And this is why the drug companies give Bush so much money. They give him millions because they get back billions.
Oh, yeah. I got another question for
sure.
You know, just like, you ever heard of Harold Zinn?
Howard Zinn.
Howard Zinn. I'm sorry.
Sure.
I mean, that guy, you know, he's got a lot of sense. I mean, where were we when we had something, you know, like Rwanda with a million lives took and show a little bit of military force, you know, drop a couple bombs, something like that. Save a lot of lives. When we just went up to $300 billion with this last passage last week that they just sort of snuck in, since, you know, Bush didn't ask for no more money, you know, they just sort
sure.
of slip it under the table, you know. It's like an open checkbook, and I didn't think democracy worked that way.
Well, that's the new form of it under Bushko. Thank you, Roger. Appreciate your call. What did I just see that? You know, 57% of us now say that they finally figured it out that this war in Iraq was a miserable undertaking, a mistake at best. But not everybody. Mark writes in from Columbus, Michigan, to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And this is one of these, I mean, how does one answer this? If we had anthrax at the post office, why can't they have had it in Iraq? I don't know. I mean, so that we're going to invade them on that basis. We have the right to be there because they were shooting at our planes. Well, Mark, where were our planes flying? Our planes were flying over their country, run by this awful man, put in by the United States, supported by the United States, supplied by the United States, and on and on and on. He was our boy during the 80s, particularly during the Republican administrations of that time. And the United States and Britain unilaterally decided that they would have these no-fly zones. And the United States aircraft routinely patrolled that. Now, what gives the United States and Britain the right to do that? And if they shot, and you're making up, I should say, you're making up rationalizations way after the fact. Bush never said, oh, maybe they'll have anthrax somewhere. He said there were weapons of mass destruction. They were in the tons, that they had the capacity to strike the United States, and that we were in imminent danger of attack, and that Saddam Hussein was an immediate menace to the region. All that is total lies. So if there's a couple envelopes of anthrax, and I've never heard anybody suggest that before, that's worth 1,601 American lives. That's worth probably by now 12,000 to 14,000 American injuries. One way you get people not to shoot at your planes is you don't go over there. I mean, it was done as a provocation. It was done to maintain the legitimacy of British and American presence in the Middle East, of which we have no inherent right. Iraq was created in this insane manner with its boundaries by Britain, because after they tried to keep it as a direct colony and met such resistance, they figured, well, boy, we can turn it into a country and rule it indirectly. And this is the Bush scheme as well. So give it up, pal. I don't think that, that doesn't make it as to the enormous loss of life that we're witnessing. Here's Funky calling from Clarkston. Funky, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
Hey, Pete, thanks for having me. I got a quick question. I don't know if you heard about this or not. Possibly, through other DJs, you know, at CSX or whatnot, but maybe three or four weeks ago, there was somebody calling in about guns or whatnot, gun rights, and the Second Amendment. And you brought up Ted Nugent, and I think you know the words were, you know, right wing wacko as it relates to guns. And I'm sure you're aware of, Bob Bauer. He has a...
Well, you know, I was letting it go when you mentioned one other station. Now you've mentioned a second station, which is... other stations don't like that, generally.
I won't mention any other stations, just individuals. I think you know Bob Bauer. He had Ted on his show, and it came up, the comments that you met or said to, regarding Ted, and came up of essentially a potential charity debate on the issue at the Novi Expo Center, and, with some type of admission charge, and whether, you may be interested in that.
Oh, whether I'd be interested in debating Ted Nugent? Well, if it was under formal guidelines, I mean, the guy is so overbearing and so whacked out that it's a little impossible to get a word in edgewise. But
guidelines equivalent to the presidential debate, I mean, would that suffice?
Sure.
And you would actually be interested in that?
Well, I may. I mean, being in front of a totally hostile audience is not necessarily the most encouraging thing. If it was people with open minds, yeah. I mean, this stuff goes unimportant stuff, like Ted Nugent. He was at some electronic show, and he was raving. Wasn't he holding up two guns? And I said that he's going to be in the remake of... when they do Bowling for Columbine 2, he's going to take what's his name's place.
Yeah, Heston, you mentioned that, and I think as far as it being a reasonable audience, I mean, most of your callers, support you, and I imagine they would be there. So I think it would probably be, at least conducive to both parties.
All right, well, get a hold of me. Just call the main number at WRIF and leave a message in my office.
Thanks, Pete.
All right. Wow, that'd be fun. I'm not even sure what the debate would be. Ted Nugent was going off on some thoroughly insane rave at this electronics convention. And, I think the man has totally lost it. Good guitar player, but That's about it. Would I debate him? This is the kind of thing that my wife would tell me, don't bother. Right? Anyways, what's the issue? I'm not even sure what the issue is here. I mean, I always shock so many people when I tell them I'm a gun owner. But I generally don't hold one in each hand at conventions and scream about it. So what are we going to say? I don't know. I don't know what the topic would be. Well, call me, dude. Let me see. We'll get Ryan from Flint. Ryan, hi. Thanks for calling from Flint. You're on the air. Go ahead.
It's an honor to speak with you. You know, I've been recently terminated from a radio station that I worked up at in Flint, Michigan, and it's an honor to talk to you. I grew up in the Detroit area, so we'll get dispensed with the first-time caller, long-time enjoyer of your opinions.
Okay.
Now, I have a question for you, because as I listen to you, I wonder, it's just a general question. I see you've had your callers meandering you around, and I don't know if you had an outline for this evening or not. But
me? Have an outline? You haven't been listening that long, Ryan. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Not tonight.
No, go ahead.
It was a different Sunday. What I'm thinking is, I'm a libertarian thinking person,
yeah.
meaning that if I want to do something, I need to find a way to provide for that to happen. The one problem that I have with right and left wing is there's too much back scratching going on. There's no indirect, no, this is what I have to do as a person that I'm a Christian man, and I believe that God made me and everybody else here for whatever reason I can never understand at the time. But
yeah.
I think that it's my job to provide for me and for those that care for and I care for.
Okay.
And my question is, I've seen that you feel more liberal, and we have a current administration that is completely off on its own family's train. But my question is, do you see necessarily as a problem with the person or a problem with the position?
Well, no, I think you hit it right on the head, and I think there's, in a sense, too much Bush bashing, although I certainly take part in it and enjoy doing it. But no, it's about policy. It's about political agendas and perspectives and what this country's going to be all about. The right has a very, very distinct agenda and a very, very distinct strategy for how they're going to accomplish that. The left, the progressives, the liberals have zero. And that's one of the reasons they or we are getting beat up so badly.
Well, one of the problems that I see is that when there was the Great Depression in this country, there was a social system set up to support that.
Right.
It was supposed to be temporary, and the law was written that as soon as it was unnecessary, they could just not fund it.
I agree.
So apparently it's still necessary, except for the fact that I'm married to a Mexican lady, and I went to Mexico recently, and they have a very different form of democracy. It's a socialist democracy,
mm-hmm.
except for there's no public assistance other than medical.
Right.
So if you want to eat, what you do is you take the front, there's no business license to be found. You take the front room of your house, and you put some lettuce, and you put some tomatoes in a tortilla and some hot sauce, and you sell them for a nickel a pop. The problem is that I see, especially in Michigan, and it's not because I know how to solve it, it's just that we're so used to relying on somebody to support us. It's not even just a social system, it's just I'm an individual, and we forget that.
Well, I mean, listen, our sense of individuality is extraordinarily important, but we all are part of these interlocking social units. I mean, there's a family, there's a neighborhood, there's a community, there's a city, there's a state, country, and internationally. And once extreme individualism begins to be the dominant mode, well, there's a few really tough, really strong, really hardworking, dedicated people that can work 70 hours a week and that don't need safety standards or don't need, you know, union protection or don't need government assistance even in their old age. But that's not the way it works out for most people. The societies that are really the best to live in for the majority of people, the government mediates social life in a beneficial manner, that it doesn't allow these huge accretions of, is that a word, of wealth to go to a tiny sliver of the population that controls almost everything and everybody, whereas then other great sectors of the population wind up in abject poverty. I mean, if we took away social supports, I don't know how people would even live. And that's going to be the real question. I mean, I think that these right-wing conservatives eventually are going to find this huge mass movement of resistance and hopefully renewal, that one that has a vision, the kind of vision that is necessary to create a renewal. Right now, we're just on the defense. And right now, I'm afraid to say that I've got to take a break. So thank you for your opinions. I appreciate it.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-M-O-R. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure, virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877, you see more. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877, you see more. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds, I'll see you.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Fifty great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Riff rocks the road. Every week, check out WRIF.com for information on upcoming Riff events. Sponsored by Wireless Toys, announcing no more activation fees. Get reimbursed for the activation fee on any new service, any new provider.
Riff rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. At 1 a.m., which is just in about 20 minutes, Ron Kovic, author of Born on the 4th of July, a brand new edition of his million-seller book, and also, of course, featured in the Oliver Stone film of the same name, featuring Tom Cruise. Now, I was going to read. I actually have about nine, I had a little pile called conservative hypocrites, like this conservative mayor accused of molesting. You know, Laura Bush, I'm actually getting into it. I want to do something else. But Laura Bush told this joke that she rehearsed about how these are the good Christian people, right, that don't sink to the level of the Whoopi Goldbergs and what have you. She told this joke at this dinner for these journalists. She said that they didn't teach ranching at Yale, so when George came to Texas, to Crawford, he tried to milk a horse, and it was a male horse. So this is this masturbation joke, this bestiality joke, told by the prim librarian wife of this devout Christian president. What hypocrites these people are. Anyways, but I should get to this. This is very important. The last caller last week said that she was really angry because foreign workers did not have to pay any income tax, any payroll tax, for the first 7 years that they were here. And Gutham writes in saying, let me see, I found a caller's comments very disturbing. I believe it was second to the last call. She was talking about all those foreigners having jobs here, etc. I'm an immigrant to this country. I work hard 60 hours a week, attend university full-time, pay my taxes, and really fed up with lots of people here in Michigan repeating the urban myth that immigrants don't pay taxes for 7 years. I thank you for the prompt clarification on the air about the fact that all are required to file taxes, including illegal immigrants. I urge you to combat such bigotry forcefully. Well, yeah, but you know, I didn't know all the facts. It just sounded crazy. And one of the things that I can do, I can't believe how many emails I got about this. David wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The 7-year exemption is a hoax. And you can go to this website. Whenever you hear stuff like that, it's a good, and sometimes when you get email with quotes in it, I always go to Snopes.com, S-N-O-P-E-S.com, Snopes.com. And there's a lot of urban myths. And also, it's kind of, if you don't want to just stick with the political stuff, it's only one category. There's lots of information there as well. Let me see, who's this? No, it's not... It's not signed. Just to let you know, foreign nationals must pay taxes in the U.S. Even illegal aliens or aliens without work permits must apply for temporary social security numbers in order to pay taxes. And there is, however, a slight deduction for taxes they might have to pay in their country of origin. In other words, if they're paying taxes there as well. But apparently there's one category here that Chuck writes in, and he says if you have a J-2 visa, which allows immigrants to take jobs to help with living and educational expenses. Upon proving their J-2 status, the company I worked for, their paychecks no longer had local, state, federal, or FICA taxes taken out. So that's, but the 7-year myth is exactly that. All right, let's try to get your calls in before we go to our Ron Kovic interview. All right, here is Robin Port here on. Rob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Oh, good. Hey, I had to call about the comment about the girls in the Army that had been raped by cadets.
Air Force.
In the Air Force.
Yeah.
Well, foolishly enough, when my daughter graduated high school, I talked her into going to the Peace Corps, joining the armed services, serving her country, and deciding what she wanted to do with her life.
Okay.
And she did. She joined the Army, and there's details I can't mention because it's still going on, But she went through boot camp, and then she got to assign to her group, and they were stationed out of the country. And the people that she had went to boot camp with and the people that she'd known to trust and take care of her spiked her drink and raped her.
Wow.
And the Army solution to this whole thing, and she got pregnant over this.
Oh, man.
And the Army solution to this was to station her back in Michigan and do nothing. Now, what kind of... What is going on with this country? I mean, we elect Bush back in office. We have our servicemen and women that are out there giving their lives and they're raping our daughters. And, oh, my God, what is going on with
this
country?
I'm sorry, I lost my mic there. It actually is a real problem. Yeah, I was reading last week this editorial in the USA. Actually, it was a guest piece about saying you shouldn't let gays in the Army because it's too intimate a situation and you don't want to make, I guess they're probably talking about males or maybe females, to feel uncomfortable. Well, the heterosexual problem is of gigantic proportions in the armed services. Rapes are endemic. There's all sorts of scandals about the kind of sexual abuse that women suffer from men. I mean, you've got people in these situations where hormones are raging at the age that most of them are at, and then they're looking at combat. It's a terrible potential, and I don't know whether it's being dealt with or not.
You know, it's not being, my daughter was in a foreign country. She'd been raped by the people she trusted. She had nowhere to go. She didn't speak the language. I mean, she was in dire straits.
Well, I don't have, and I don't know if you even called for that. I mean, I certainly don't have any advice or anything, but if there are channels open to keep on pushing that understandably angry parent of someone who suffered that, I would just keep on it and push and push. You might try just contacting your congressman and see what he or she
We've done quite a bit.
Well, good.
We're still trying to get this resolved because all of these gentlemen are still, well, young men, are still in the service and they're still serving their country like nothing happened.
Wow.
And on the other hand, my daughter's here, and she's pregnant, and she's humiliated, disgusted. She trusted these people. Some of these young men I've actually met, they've been to my home. And I cannot believe that the Army hung her out like the way they did. I mean, my God. And when you had mentioned that, and it just... I've been dealing with this for about 9 months now. I just had to call and say something.
Well, I don't know if you... Did you have any idea of the scope of this?
How big it is?
Yeah.
Well, they're waiting for... The end deal of this is they're waiting for her to have the child.
Yeah.
And they're going to DNA test everybody. But they're going to... What's going to happen is they're going to hold one person accountable for everything. And the group that she was with, there was like 25 guys there. And they're going to hold one person accountable. I cannot believe this.
Well, I just while you were talking, I just put in rape armed services. And, I can't believe this. This is one of 4,280,000 entries. Including female GIs report rapes in Iraq war. Female GI, well, it's the same thing. Often videotaped during rape to blackmail their families. Whole series on rape in the military. On and on and on.
Oh, she has suffered so much harassment just from the military.
Yeah, wow.
And it's incredible. I cannot believe it. It's this bad. I just cannot believe that.
Majority of sexual assaults remain unreported in armed services. Why war? Female GIs report rapes in Iraq war. On and on and on. I mean, so we're talking about something that's not just like torture. I mean, we think, well, there was a little bit. We saw it about Abu Ghraib. We're facing some terrible problems that aren't being addressed. Well, look, I can't do much more, Rob, than just
tell you that all. I just wanted to be heard.
Well, I think you deserve to be heard and loudly. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye now. See, that's the kind of thing that it's like, and I can just imagine a lot of people sort of psychologically putting their fingers in the air and go, la, 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 la. So we have the systemic torture. That is, that it's happening throughout the military apparatus, from Afghanistan to Guantanamo, the transfer of prisoners to these torture states, what we're learning about in Iraq. You know, I was listening to this right-wing show for about 5 minutes, about the only amount I can take, and this well-known right-wing talk show host was defending this GI that's accused of murdering two Iraqis. And it's kind of complicated, but the end of it was he shot these two Iraqi men, unarmed Iraqi men, in the back 50 to 60 times with an automatic weapon. Just pulverized them, and he's pleading self-defense. And these right-wingers, they're defending that, and that's sweet. Here's Hayes in Ann Arbor. Hayes, Peter Werby, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for answering my call.
Sure. Thanks for waiting.
I think this ties right in with what we have been talking about with all of this mayhem over there with the troops. And there was an article, and it was a couple months ago, and maybe even I heard it more than once, but it was about keeping classified documents from being released and reclassifying information previously released.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking specifically about some of the Vietnam War data. And I just have to conclude that Bush is protecting his people from prosecution and war crimes prosecution. And I think that there is a taste right now for a little bit of American blood when it comes to the world at large wanting to make the U.S. accountable for war crimes. And
well, no one in the United States military. If somebody, what has been committed in Iraq essentially is what's called under the United Nations Charter a crime against peace. And since not only did Bush violate the terms that he initially sought approval on, remember they were trying to get UN approval when it was clear that they weren't, because he had to rush quickly, because if they would have waited a month, it would have been clear that there were no weapons of mass destruction because the inspectors were there. So this is a violation that that meets the criteria, as far as I'm concerned, of a war crime. But the United States, under Bush, has never signed on to the World Court, specifically because this kind of activity occurs frequently within the United States, and Bush does not want to put himself or others in a position where they would be subject to the same things that we would expect others to submit to.
Oh, I agree, and I think we can go one step further in saying that that's probably the biggest reason he doesn't want to let go of Iraq, because right now Iraq could turn around and prosecute the U.S. for war crimes on many counts because of the unbelievable way that will be uncovered that he has handled the population of Iraq in general.
Yeah, of all the scandals, I mean, the scandal of all scandals, that there was no weapons of mass destruction and the intelligence was cooked, the systemic torture going on, this is what we found out while they are in office.
Right.
Wait till it all comes out. I think that's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you,
definitely.
Hayes. Thank you so much. Here's a caller from Detroit. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Peter. How are you doing? Let me turn on my radio.
Sure. I didn't get your name. And who's this?
This is Adam from Detroit.
Go ahead, Adam. You're on the air.
I kind of want to, hopefully you don't mind, I'm going to get off topic. I think earlier you were talking about hypocrisy in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Was it about 20 minutes ago or so?
Sure.
Okay. I have a friend out in California. I just spoke with him this weekend. Him and his wife, I actually went to their wedding a couple years ago. They're both Republicans, I just learned through our conversation. When I went to their wedding, it was off of a $10 million estate off the coast of California. And I was wondering who, funded the wedding. It turns out his wife's family hit it pretty big in the oil and gas industry. So thus, her family is pretty well off. His family is, middle class. Anyways, I talked to him over the weekend. We started talking about politics. And I assumed his wife, she's a school teacher, that she was a Democrat. And he goes, oh, no, she's a red-blooded Republican.
Hmm.
And make a long story short, he told me that prior to them getting married, when she was very younger, she had had two abortions. So I go along the lines of the pro-life kind of hypocrisy where, you know, Republicans are supposed to be, you know, pro-life. Well, she's pro-choice. So I guess the whole thing is that, and he calls himself a liberal Republican. So that's just hypocritical.
Now, maybe of the Arnold variety out there, there may be a few left. You know, actually, Arnold Schwarzenegger is pro-life and he supports gay rights. And you would think that, that you wouldn't want to make people's personal choices a matter of law.
What got John Kerry in trouble as a Catholic and as a Democrat, he has to be pro-choice.
Yeah.
That goes against the religious doctrine of the Catholic Church. You have to be pro-life. So that kind of hypocrisy goes both ways.
Well, it does, and that's why the Cardinal Ratzinger, now Benedict the whatever, intervened in the U.S. election to say that that Catholics should not vote for anybody that doesn't support their strict view of abortion. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. I'm just taking these now, Jay, in terms of who's been waiting the longest. In fact, I'm going to have to make this the last call, I'm sorry to say. Here's John from Ypsilanti. John, it's Peter Werby. Go ahead.
Hello. Christopher, I'm a little off topic again. But,
that's okay.
what doesn't seem to be talked about much lately is the attack in New York last week, terrorist attack.
Well, terrorist? Somebody did it, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if that's all they can put together, that's pretty good. It's better than the last one.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about it is I seem to remember in the campaign last fall, wasn't it Dick Cheney that said that if you elect Kerry, there will be an attack on the United States? Well, here we are. It's not even 6 months into the new regime, and we're attacked.
Well, there you go. It's still not much of one. I'm going to get one more call, John. Thank you. Jake's been waiting a long time from LaSalle. Hey, Jake, hi. You're on the air. You're our last caller for sure.
Yeah. Good evening or good morning.
Yeah, hi.
On your point of view.
Yeah.
I just wanted to address Rob. That's not why I called.
But go ahead.
But I'll tell you what. If somebody had raped my daughter, not only would I give my full name and be raising hell to high heaven, I'd be demanding answers to it, and I wouldn't be calling in talk shows.
Well, I think he, from what he sounded, let's be fair.
He sounded like a liar to me.
What? A liar?
Okay, yeah.
You know what? You've been waiting a long time, but I guess I don't want to hear that as my last caller, so thanks for calling. Anyway, sounded like a liar. Wow. How weird. By the way, I just wanted to say, too, one caller said, would I be interested in debating Ted Nugent? Lonnie writes in, don't do the numgent thing. It's a setup. We'll talk more about that next week. Stay tuned for Ron Kovic, author of Born on the 4th of July. Thanks for calling.
Listening to WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants. Like the Shark Club on Ford Road, just east of Canton Center Road in Canton. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Boss Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-U-C-MORE. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds, I'll see you.
Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever, on your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money and that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's spring 2005 semester. Final walk-in registration for spring classes is May 5th and 6th. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's five convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is May 5th and 6th. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Classes begin May 9th.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
On 101WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. A lot of anniversaries coming upon us. A lot of them in rock and roll. We're always pleased to get the 30th and 40th anniversary. A lot of very serious ones as well. This week is the 30th anniversary of the final evacuation of the United States embassy in Saigon, the defeat of the U.S. after so many years in that war. The 35th anniversary of Kent State, state murders, essentially, where four students were shot down by the National Guard on May 4th, 1970. And I say with so many other people, we remember. And speaking of remembering, I'm sure almost everyone listening knows the name Ron Kovic. Ron Kovic wrote the New York Times bestseller, more than a million copies sold, Born on the 4th of July. If you haven't read the book, and there's a new edition of it out, and that's what we're going to talk with Ron about, grab it for sure. You may remember it, though, from the movie starring Tom Cruise, who played the role of Ron Kovic in the 1989 Oliver Stone the movie, and also got an Academy Award. Ron Kovic, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Now, your book was written in 1976, so can I do math here? Was that 24 years, or is it 34?
Actually, Peter, I wrote it in the fall of 1974 in Santa Monica, California, on a $42 manual Sears and Roebuck typewriter. I went out to Sears and Roebuck, and I bought a manual typewriter, and I wrote it in exactly 1 month, 3 weeks, and 2 days, the first draft of the book anyway, 1 month, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
Well, now you have a new edition out by Akashic Books, and I want to ask you something just about one of the endorsements on the back cover by Robert Shearer, the Los Angeles Times columnist who's been a guest on this show before.
LA Times columnist.
Yeah. He says, there is no book more relevant in the 21st century to healing the wound of Vietnam. Why is it still a wound?
But it is a wound for many of us. I think of the present situation in Iraq, and I think of how many people quickly got behind the war and got behind committing our young men and women to going to Iraq. And I wondered, I think those of us who have served in war, those of us who have been directly affected, wounded in combat, we see things a little bit differently, and we're much more inclined to be a little bit more thoughtful, a little bit more cautious about making that very difficult decision of sending young men and women into harm's way. And we know, we've lived with the after effects of that war. We know what happens. We know the journey. We've been on that journey, that long and painful and difficult journey in the years after the war. So I'm thinking of the healing of that war, and I don't think people realize that when a war ends, in many ways, it's just beginning for us. So many veterans from the Vietnam War suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. So many veterans had lingering effects from that war that lasted for many decades, nightmares, anxiety attacks. Many made good adjustments, did their very best, but so many others ended up troubled, and as we know, many of our Vietnam veterans are homeless to this day.
Mm-hmm. Now, I should remind people that you, Ron Kovic, served two tours of duty during the Vietnam War.
I did. I volunteered to go back to Vietnam a second time. I truly was born on the 4th of July. That's my birthday. July 4th, 1946 is my real birthday.
Huh.
And I grew up very patriotic on Long Island, in Massapequa, Long Island. I was actually born in the Midwest. I was born in Wisconsin. I've been to Detroit once. I want everyone to know that I've actually been to the great city of Detroit once, and I was there for about 1 day. So that's my journey to the beautiful city of Detroit. I spent 1 day in Detroit.
Well, we're glad to get you back on the air.
It was a pleasure to be there.
Mm-hmm. And on your second tour, you were paralyzed from the chest down in combat.
I was. I lasted a couple of months. I was leading my squad across an open area on January 20th. This was just, I believe this was a couple of days before the beginning of, this was on the eve of the Tet Offensive, and this was a couple of days before the beginning of the Tet Offensive, and there was a great deal of activity north of the river where we were. I was north in the northern part of South Vietnam at the time, a place called Qua Viet, the mouth of the river Qua Viet, and on January 20th, 1968, I led my squad across an open area. There was a battalion of Marines in back of us, and I was shot in the right foot. It blew out the back of my heel, and then I continued to try to move forward, and I went down to my hands and knees, laid down in a prone position, as I write in the first chapter of Born on the 4th of July, and I tried to return fire. My rifle jammed in the sand, and I started to get up, and just as I moved, just as I pushed myself up, there was a loud crack next to my right ear that sounded like a firecracker going off. That's the only way I can describe it. And I just felt this tremendous, as if someone I'd been hit by a train, something a tremendous force had pushed me backward, and it suddenly I couldn't feel anything at all. It was as if Peter, my body had suddenly disappeared, and I thought for a moment that that my first thought was maybe I had been blown in half. I had been hit by a mortar. That was my first feeling, because I never suddenly, instantly lost the feeling of my body, and it was as if it was gone. And in a way, it was gone, but it was still there. I reached back with my right hand, and I felt with a relief. I felt my body was still there, but I couldn't feel it anymore. So everything from my mid chest down, from that moment, became paralyzed as the bullet went through my right shoulder, through my right lung, collapsing my right lung, and hitting my spine at about 2,200 feet per second. It shattered my right spine, and it left me permanently paralyzed for the rest of my life.
And you've been in a wheelchair ever since. So it's impossible then, really, to forget your experience. Obviously.
Pardon me?
I say that since you've been in a wheelchair ever since, it's impossible for you to forget that experience.
It is, but you know, it's been an extraordinary journey for me. I feel, as I write in the introduction of the new edition of my book, Born on the 4th of July, in many ways my life has been a blessing in disguise. In many ways, I've been able to, you know, there's always, I think it's important, I think everyone listening would agree with me that there's always two sides to the coin. You know, we don't always see the two sides, especially when something as tragic as being paralyzed for the rest of your life occurs, or some great tragedy occurs in your life. I think you don't realize that there's always another side. There's always something where there's something terrible, and where there's something tragic, there is inevitably always something beautiful. And I was able to find that meaning in my life, in my commitment to peace and nonviolence. I was inspired by Martin Luther King in the months and in the years after I returned from Vietnam. In fact, Martin Luther King did not live that long. After being wounded, I was in the Da Nang intensive care ward. I went to Japan. I was sent on with a jet plane filled with American wounded from Vietnam, packed with American wounded. We went back to the United States alive, thankful to be alive, even though many of us were badly wounded. I eventually ended up at the St. Albans Naval Hospital on Long Island, and then the Bronx Veterans Administration Hospital in New York. But it was at the St. Albans Naval Hospital in the spring of 1968. And remember, I was wounded on January 20th, 1968. So that spring was actually a very violent spring, a very sorrowful spring for America. When I was at that hospital, I knew of Martin Luther King. I'd never met him personally, though as the years went on, I had the honor of not only meeting his wife, Coretta Scott King, but also meeting Daddy King when he was still alive. But that's another story. But in that spring of 1968, as I was recuperating with other wounded at the St. Albans Naval Hospital in New York, got to see my parents for the first time. I was so thankful to be alive at first, even though I had been paralyzed, even though in Da Nang, Vietnam, I had been told that I would never walk again. I think what I felt is what many young men and women wounded coming back from Iraq feel. I mean, what you feel, I mean, even with these grievous wounds, which really I feel this great sorrow when I see those coming home wounded from Iraq. I identify with what happened to me, my generation, those hospitals, those my own particular wound and what that was like. But I do remember there was the thrill, the gratefulness of simply being alive, of having made it out of there alive, having not died, having not been killed, because it was a battle of life and death for many of us in the intensive care wards in those early days right after we were wounded. And there was this feeling that seemed to override everything else. It was, even though we had been paralyzed, lost our bodies, amputated legs, there was a part of us that was simply thrilled to be alive. And it was in that spring of feeling that joy of simply being there, of whatever I have to do now to get back into this world, I'm going to do it. That was when Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Right.
And I was in the hospital, and I remember I knew of Martin Luther King. I had watched him as a boy growing up in Massapequa, Long Island. I knew that he was a leader in the civil rights movement. I knew that when he took a stand against the war in Vietnam, it was very controversial. I knew that he had given a very controversial speech at the Riverside Church in New York. I knew of all these things, but I had not yet been influenced by his philosophy of nonviolence and of peace and nonviolence. And I remember it was sad. I felt very sad that this had happened and what was happening to my country. The country seemed to have, there was so much violence, so much discord. If you think back, and if we all think back to America in the late 60s, in the 1968, when I was wounded in that spring, America seemed to be falling apart. There were National Guardsmen with their bayonet in the streets, and were they not in the streets of Detroit?
Sure, 1967. Yeah, let me reintroduce you, Ron. Ron Kovic is my guest, if you're just joining us. He's the author of the million-seller Born on the 4th of July, and there's a new edition out with a new introduction by Ron. If you go to akashicbooks.com, that's A-K-A-S-H-I books.com. You can click on a link for that, and also I'll have it on my site at peterwerby.com as well. You know, Ron Kovic, you said that you felt just this almost this thrill about being alive. Was there ever anger at the man who shot you, or President Johnson, or
you? I never. That's a very interesting question. I never felt anger at the man who shot me. I didn't really even think about the fact that one particular the person had shot me. I was, first of all, it's important to remember that I volunteered to join the Marine Corps out of high school in 1967. I went to Parris Island, South Carolina. I wanted to be a Marine. My uncle had been a Marine. My mother and father had both served in the Navy during World War II. I was inspired by John F. Kennedy, inspired by his, I believe it was his inaugural address, when he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." I wanted to serve my country, and I was particularly patriotic. I grew up very, very happy to be born on the country's birthday, and but as time went by, I remember it was a couple of years ago, I was reflecting and I was thinking of the man, Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese Army soldier who shot me. I forgave him. I not personally. I never met him. If I did meet him, I would hold no grudges against him. We were put in a very difficult place, a very difficult situation. I did begin to slowly turn against the war. And this was a very, this did not happen overnight. This happened very slowly. And then I was eventually on the West Coast to join the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I was to protest the war for many, many years. I was arrested on numerous occasions for protesting the Vietnam War. But let's go back for a moment to the Bronx Veterans
Sure.
Hospital, where I was sent right after the St. Albans Naval Hospital. Now, many of our Iraqi wounded are coming home, and they're going to end up in the veterans hospital system too. I was very surprised when I got to the Bronx VA, as depicted in the movie Born on the 4th of July, the poor conditions that we were subjected to when we entered the Veterans Administration. I think it's now called the Veterans Affairs. I'm getting older, but it's
mm-hmm.
Veterans Affairs. But back then it was called the Veterans Administration Hospital. Paraplegic wards, overcrowded conditions, understaffed, people pushing call buttons, no one ever coming, people laying in their own excrement for hours at a time, no one helping. our veterans deserve better than this. Our veterans don't deserve to be treated this way. I'm very concerned about our veterans coming back from the Iraq War, in particular, especially the wounded veterans coming back from the Iraq War, both physically and emotionally wounded. Those coming back, I'm hoping that this government and the Veterans Affairs or Veterans Administration, that they're given the very best care. They deserve the very best care. They don't deserve shoddy treatment. They don't deserve to feel as if they've been sent to a prison in a hospital. These young men and women, right or wrong, have sacrificed their bodies, and they put their lives on the line for us, and they deserve the very best. Now, when I was at the Bronx VA, I remember one night watching the Chicago demonstrations, 1968. Do you remember those?
At the Democratic Convention.
That's right, Peter. Yeah. That's right. And I remember watching that, and I remember. Now, I was in my room with other Vietnam veterans who had been paralyzed. Some were quadriplegics. I was a paraplegic. There was one gentleman in the room who was paralyzed from the neck down. And they were very angry at the protesters that night. That night, when we remember the demonstrators in Chicago and Mayor Daley, and there seemed to be chaos in the streets of Chicago, and the students and the protesters were shouting. I remember there was one chant they were shouting was, "The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching." And I remember the veterans in my room were very angry at the demonstrators, calling them names, cursing at them. And I remember that night I felt differently. That was that a change was beginning to occur within me. I began to feel a certain empathy with the protesters who were being beaten by the police. Now, I know that this is not so... this was a very complex situation, but I was still very much affected by... I began to feel for these young men and women who are opposing this war, who are willing to face the clubs of these policemen in Chicago that were being thrown into the paddy wagon. That night affected me. And then the killings at Kent State on May 4th, 1970, that affected me. By then, I was out of the hospital. I was going to college on Long Island, and I remember I was affected by that day. That sent a real jolt through me, as it did many Americans on that day. And I went down to the university, and it was that weekend that I attended my first anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C. I went down with my cousin's husband. I wrote a chapter about it in Born on the 4th of July. And that demonstration affected me very deeply. And it was not long after that that I began to do interviews against the war in Vietnam. I began to speak out against the war in Vietnam. And I just felt that the direction that our country was heading in Vietnam at that time was the wrong direction. It was hurting America, not helping America, and that we needed to change course. I feel the same way about the situation in Iraq right now. I feel that I support our young men and women who are serving there, but I am very, very disheartened by this policy, by the way we were misled into this war, by the way we were rushed into this war very quickly. And as we know, many of our young soldiers, our men and women now serving over there, they were not given the proper body armor. They were not prepared.
Yeah, in fact, a real mess. Now, a little belatedly, but about 57% of Americans, I just saw USA Today poll today, say they think it was a mistake. Ron Kovacs, before we run out of time and we have under 5 minutes, let me ask you two questions. One about the movie, Born on the 4th of July, and the other one about the reissue of the book of the same title.
Well, I'm very grateful for the movie. It was... you know, I feel there's not a day that goes by, Peter, that I'm not grateful that film happened. I feel like one of the luckiest people in the world.
And you're happy with the portrayal?
I was very, very pleased with the portrayal. It's a long story, and we could have taken the whole interview talking about the movie, but I just want to say what an honor it was to work with Oliver Stone. I co-wrote the screenplay with Oliver Stone. You know, I'll tell you something very interesting, and I think some of your listeners might enjoy this. I won the Golden Globe because I co-wrote the screenplay of Born on the 4th of July with Oliver Stone, and I was also nominated for an Academy Award. But I just want to say, I want to share this with you, that I won the Golden Globe, and the Golden Globe ceremony was held in Los Angeles. I believe it was at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. It was on January 20th, 1990. And ironically, that was exactly 22 years to the day. It was my anniversary. It was 22 years to the day that I was wounded in Vietnam. So 22 years to the day, to that anniversary that I was wounded. And let me say, for many years, that anniversary, the anniversary of the day that I was shot and almost lost my life in Vietnam and somehow survived, that was a difficult day for me, to say the least. That I felt an anxiety leading up to that week, and I felt a definite anxiety on that day. But on that day, on that difficult anniversary, something very miraculous happened in 1990, 22 years later. We just about swept the Golden Globes that night. We won just about every Golden Globe, and I won the Golden Globe and went up with Oliver Stone, and I was able to speak. And Tom Cruise won for Best Actor that night. And when Tom won, he knew that it was my anniversary. He knew that it was a very significant day in my life, the day that I had been wounded in Vietnam, and how ironic that on this night of the Golden Globe, and we were, that he had won the Golden Globe, and we were winning the Golden Globe that night. We won for Best Picture, Best Director, and Tom won deservedly. And Tom said, he spoke beautiful words, and he understood. He understood the significance. He understood what an important day it was for me, and how ironically things had come full circle on that day. And I remember driving back to my home in Redondo Beach, California at the time, from L.A., with the Golden Globe next to me, and thinking, how amazing, what an amazing coincidence that on that very anniversary of my wounding in the war, we would affect so many people on that night. And I'm so grateful that this film came out and that it was able to touch so many lives. I hope that it gave something back to those that have seen this film, and I hope those of you that have not seen the film get a chance to look at it, because I think it's a beautiful film. I think it's a difficult film to watch, but I think it's a beautiful film nonetheless.
Based on the book, Born on the 4th of July, it was first copyrighted in 1976. Akashic Books has brought it out again. It has a new introduction by the author, Ron Kovic. The Pittsburgh Press says this book will make you cry, but it's also a novel, ultimately, of redemption, of hope. Can you say this, Ron Kovic, in about 20 seconds? Why is the cover all white? Which is type?
Why is it all white? Well, it's red and white.
Yeah, red type. White.
And it's very simple, and we decided to do a very simple cover, and we're very proud of it. I think it's a beautiful cover, and it's not the cover, and it's what's inside the book that really counts.
And there's a lot in there.
And what more is to be said on the cover? You know, so many covers that come out today are filled with pictures and filled with an attempt to sell the book to you. This is a very simple cover. It says Born on the 4th of July, with an introduction by myself, and I'm honored to have the New York Times quote. It says classic and timeless on the cover. You know, we don't need any more. The film has come out. Tom Cruise has portrayed my life. The book was on the front page of the Sunday New York Times Book Review when it came out in 1976. I don't think we need to say much. much on the cover. I think it's there. It's waiting for you. And it's my, you know, in the beginning of the book.
Well, let me just say that unfortunately we are not timeless, and you are going to have to get the rest of the story by picking up the Akashic Books edition of Born on the 4th of July by Ron Kovics with a new introduction by the author. Ron Kovic, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much, Peter. It was a pleasure.
WRIF.com.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-M-O-R. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-UC-MORE. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-UC-MORE. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net. UCMORE.com. Bill Bonds. I'll see you.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Shields, ideal for business lunches and family dinners, with locations in Southfield, Troy, Dearborn, Commerce Township, and their newest location in Warren. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Stakes to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Thank you.
WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. We're recording this on May 4th. May 4th is the 35th anniversary of the state murder of the four students at Kent State, and I'd like to dedicate this show to them and to their memory. We remember. You can see that on my website, peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. And we shouldn't forget that. Joining me from New York is Peter Cooper. Peter Cooper is the author of graphic novels, many of them, in fact, and among them, The System, Speechless, an award-winning adaptation of Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis, and brand new, an adaptation of Upton Sinclair's classic, The Jungle. Peter Cooper, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And also Sticks and Stones. I shouldn't forget that as well. I just got that from Three Rivers Press, The Jungle, the adaptation from NBM Publishers as well. You know, Peter, I've done tons of interviews, mostly nonfiction and sometimes novels, but the first time with a graphic novelist. Is there a difference? I mean, is it the kind of thing if you say comic, you go, wait a minute, man, we're graphic artists. Is there a difference between graphic art or graphic novels, rather, and comic books?
They're longer form often, but we're kind of that troubling place where we don't have the right terms to use for it. I mean, even comics is kind of a funny term, considering it's not always funny. And when people say comics, they always think it's something for kids. The kind of thing I do is occasionally something that younger people can read, but very often I do it for peers and for, you know, it's kind of adult, which doesn't necessarily mean sex and drugs and rock and roll, but it does mean that it's for an audience who would read literature and be look at art in general and not be not just genre superhero type fans.
Tell us some about when really the graphic novel came about, because I guess in my memory, I think about Classics Illustrated, the authors of those long ago took the great novels of history and transformed them into comic books. And the many English teachers, they were the bane of them because they thought people should read the original. Tell us about how this all came about.
Well, the term graphic novel was coined by Will Eisner, who created The Spirit, and he was a huge figure in the field, and he coined this term in, I think, 1978 with his graphic novel, A Contract with God, which was, not a genre thing. It was he did a lot of different stories that were personal and not didn't fit into the categories that we generally understood. But there's been variations of what you could call a graphic novel for years before that, and there have been comics that have definitely been for more of an adult audience going back you could go far enough back to say some of the wordless picture books by Lynn Ward, who was doing basically like a graphic novel back in the 20s, and he's somebody that Will Eisner cites as being one of his influences. But not to get too technical here, Will Eisner actually just died recently, and
he
was
yeah.
Then there was things like Mouse by Art Spiegelman that was dealing with the Holocaust, using cats and mice as drawing the Germans as cats and Jews as mice, and there's a lot of great material, especially now, that's out there that is it's aimed at a more adult audience. There's things like Jimmy Corrigan by Chris Ware and Blankets by Craig Thompson. And if you go into a bookstore these days, you find more and more there's an area where you can find graphic novels. Unfortunately, they still sort of shove them in a kind of general, you know, it looks like they've thrown them at the shelf and they haven't figured out how to subdivide them.
Well, they don't get in a sense the respect that they deserve in terms of the creativity. By the way, I did notice I've looked at your adaptation of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle any number of times, and I just noticed on the bottom right hand corner it says NBM Comics Lit. So they still have that reference. But I think, do you feel like graphic novelists are in the same position, say, as science fiction writers and detective genre writers? I know when I've interviewed them, they often express a resentment that they're not considered full sort of participants in literature, but rather sort of relegated to these subcategories.
That's perpetually been the case with comics, but just right at this point in time, that seems to be changing because it seems to be the hot area in publishing, and there are a lot more people who are a lot of publishers who are getting interested in picking up books by by comic artists, and there's Scholastic is got an imprint. In fact, just about every publisher out there is starting to have an imprint doing something with graphic novels. So right now they're hitting this sort of new respectability, and it's unclear how that's all going to shake out and whether there'll be a lot of failures that and publishers will get cold feet. But for years and years, I mean, basically all the people I know that did comics were doing them for almost no money, and certainly when you were doing something that wasn't a superhero comic and more personal or political work, that you essentially did it out of your desperate need to do it and not because there was any kind of financial remuneration for it. And so that's one of the reasons why it's been sort of so slow to take off as a field, mm-hmm. because it's really hard to do something as involved as a comic it involves knowing how to letter and storytelling on an individual page, but also a spread of more than one page and then the overall story. I mean, there's so many elements that have to come into play, and so some people, it takes them a decade before they put all those pieces together and can come out with these full formed work. Like say, Mouse took I think 13 years to come about, and something like Jimmy Corrigan was a 10-year project, and Dan Klaus, who co-wrote Ghost World, a lot of the work that he did there, he was working on for also the same thing, like a decade, and mostly for very little pay. So but it's just now hitting the sort of respectability, and we'll see how that all shakes out. Curiously, the Jungle I originally did for a revived Classics Illustrated that came out in the early 90s, yeah. And so it has that sort of curious association. But I did Metamorphosis, and previous to that I did some short stories by Kafka, and I just found that that the words, in Kafka's case, his words were so evocative that they really let me be free to do all sorts of wild storytelling approaches and yet have it remain anchored with the words. And a lot of times I think that the Classics Illustrated sort of did this reductive thing that wasn't so good, and it did in certain ways undermine the original book because it was so reductive. But I think there's a tremendous amount of possibilities yet with exploring that marriage between literature mm-hmm. and comics.
Peter Cooper is my guest. Peter's last name is spelled K-U-P-E-R, and I believe your website is petercooper.com.
That's right.
Yeah, a lot of interesting art and connections to all of these books. We're talking about his adaptation of Upton Sinclair's classic novel about the stockyards in the early part of the 20th century, the jungle, and the horrible circumstances there. Also, Sticks and Stones, and that's published by Three Rivers Press as well. Now, I'm little, I'm interested in continuing on this idea of what graphic novels does to literature. And just hearing you talk for a little while, I think everyone realizes that you're a literate person in the sense, in the more precise sense of it, that I suspect you have read a lot and you continue to read a lot. There is, though, the idea that people begin to read less and less, and that they can conceive ideas less and less because of the lack of ability to formulate ideas through reading and what comes about through reading. So I just wonder whether there is a danger here, or whether you have any ambivalence about what this does to an audience.
No, I have zero ambivalence.
Okay.
Because in a lot of ways, I think that the fear that parents had about comics that goes, you know, back to a point in, say, the 50s when they actually put together a Senate subcommittee to talk about how comics were polluting the minds of children and leading to, you know, delinquency and whatnot. The literacy that comes with being able to read a comic is actually a very involved skill, and a lot of people, I think, are put off by comics because they don't even know how to enter them. You know, they look at the pictures and where you're supposed to go, and that it actually takes a certain amount of experience looking at comics. You know, hopefully not so much that people are daunted by that, but that it's an art form that requires a certain visual literacy,
mm-hmm.
and that it helps to develop that by, you know, by looking at comics. And for me, that's, you know, I grew up reading comics, and it was hugely important to my general, what I would say is my general literacy and that we're a very visual society, and comics I see as kind of going back to something very, very primal too. I mean, if you look at hieroglyphics or cave paintings, it was like storytelling with pictures before there was language, and that with that in mind, I actually am very drawn to picture stories that don't use words, and that Sticks and Stones is a 128-page allegory that could be about the Bush administration or about the Roman Empire or about just the general idea of empires rising and hubris and where that leads, done with no words.
I actually wanted to mention that. I was going to say we've gone to another step forward, a very compelling book, Sticks and Stones, Peter Cooper's latest release. It's about, as you mentioned, the rise of empire, the consequences of hubris, of arrogance. And why no words? Why did you select that? Was that... because, like, you know, actually, I don't know where you would put them on, certainly on these drawings, but any comic artist, if they're going to have voice balloons or text below it, makes room for it. So you didn't. Why that choice?
Well, a couple of reasons. It seems to be my ongoing battle to remain or to fight boredom and remain very interested in what I'm doing. And I had just come off of working on adapting Kafka's Metamorphosis, and that is utterly wordful. And so when I finished with that and dealing with the text and how to manage all that, I wanted to go a completely different direction and just use the images. But I also very much like the idea of being able to communicate with people through images and not and have no language barriers, and that can run the scale of, you know, a younger pre-literate kid. I have a young daughter who was looking at what I was doing and deciphering it, and also having traveled a lot, I really like the idea of being able to use comics as a language that can bridge that gap.
Yeah, you could give Sticks and Stones to anyone anywhere in the world, couldn't you?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I very much, you know, I mean, a lot of probably why I'm drawn to working in comics is just a general desire to communicate with people, and that is one, you know, the wordless comic is one of those things that is exclusively has that ability. Because of my interest in wordless comics, and I've done a lot of them over the years, I had a syndicated strip called Eye of the Beholder that was wordless, that ran for about 10 years in various alternative papers, and I did an entire graphic novel called The System for DC Vertigo that was all wordless, and it was, I mean, with a few a few newspaper headlines here and there, but otherwise no dialogue. And that led Mad Magazine to contact me, and they've had me take over Spy vs. Spy, which is a wordless comic for Mad Magazine that I grew up reading. And
Peter Cooper, you are anticipating every one of my questions, which is fine. No, that's fine. That's fine. It makes my job easier. But yeah, tell us some about Mad Magazine. I have to say, I haven't read it in ages and ages and ages. And is it are you drawing Spy versus Spy for Mad in the same style that it always has been?
Not at all, actually.
Really?
When they approached me about this, it was at a point in my career where the idea of taking over somebody's strip and doing, you know, existing characters was kind of antithetical to what I had been doing. And since I write and draw, there was, you know, why would I want to do that? But I thought, oh, I'll just give it a shot. What the hell? And when I sat down to do my sample page, I just found, like, I remembered how much that strip had meant to me and how much Mad Magazine had meant to me growing up, and it was really pretty much what formed my concept of politics and the social, and laughing at the pillars of society and how Mad Magazine's ability to use humor and throw in politics in there and be extremely entertaining while talking about heavy subjects was one of the, you know, primary places I learned about these things. And so being part of that was a pretty big draw. And when I sat down to draw it, I found it was sort of like encoded on my DNA with these characters, and the storytelling without words was very appealing. And so I found the idea of that 10-year-old boy I once was that read that, and that out there is some kid who, like me, was being subverted by what was in the magazine. I thought, wow, this is a great opportunity to get them while they're young. And I'm in my eighth year of doing it, and I do it every month. But I do it in stencils, and I thought I would go as outrageous a direction as possible, and if they didn't like what I did, then it would, you know, that would kill it right there. But I wouldn't be just mimicking the style of Antonio Proxias, the Cuban artist who started it back in 1961. It just didn't appeal to me to try to be a just walk in those giant pointy shoes of his. So by doing it in stencils, I actually cut paper, spray paint, and so it gives it this sort of kind of fuzzy, half-tony feel. And when it a couple of years ago went to color, that was ideal because I the stencil works beautifully in color, and so now I can do I do generally what I am doing with my illustration and thing and other book projects like Sticks and Stones or The System, but do it with Spy versus Spy.
Well, that's great. I'll have to pick up a Mad Magazine and check it out. Has Mad Magazine ever rejected a strip of yours?
That's a regular feature of the job. Now, it's one of the drawbacks to being, you know, in a freelance situation. I can sit around and work all day and then hand in my ideas and have them reject the whole thing. I mean, it would be like if you went to your job, worked all day, and then at the end of the day they said, we really didn't like what you did and you're not going to get your paycheck.
Boy.
And so it is a tightrope walk in that respect, but I have a pretty good idea of what's going to fly, and so it's kind of like buzzing in the back of my head as the deadline approaches, and I usually manage to pull it off right within that time frame.
Great. Well, Peter Cooper, we have so much more to talk about. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Peter Cooper, K-U-P-E-R, petercooper.com is his website, and I'll link it to mine at peterwerbe.com. I'm looking at the time. We have so much we haven't talked about. You also do illustrations regularly for Time Magazine and the New York Times. I read the New York Times every day. Is it your illustrations that are like on the letters page?
Op-ed. Yeah, I have over the years done work for them, and at different points I work for all parts of the paper. And but it's just, you know, it's sort of a periodic thing where I'll get you know, just called out of the blue.
Yeah, they want real. I know some artists that do that. They want real quick turnarounds. Well, let's go a little further into things. Tell us about Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. And here, I'll give you the framework. We have about 6 minutes left, so I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about World War III Illustrated, a political zine as well. So tell us about Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, from 100 years ago, about the horrible conditions in the Chicago stockyards and why this appealed to you as a graphic novel.
When I first read it when I was in college, and it was just one of those books that it was really visceral, and it made me and a lot of people vegetarians for years.
yeah.
I've returned to meat for one reason or another, but it was just, you know, the impact of of a book like that. The impact on American society was that Teddy Roosevelt, the president at that time, called Upton Sinclair to the White House, and because of that book, they enacted the Pure Food and Drug laws that we have today. And so, the idea of a book that had that much of a powerful political effect, the idea that art can do that, it was very appealing to me. And when they revived Classics Illustrated briefly in the late 80s and early 90s and asked me to, if I would like to do one and to pick a book that was in the public domain, that was the one that immediately came to my mind. And because in general, when I do a comic, I feel like it's got to be something that really can sustain my interest. And since I seem to be perpetually on edge about the state of the world, then I always want to find something that I can pour my energy into that I feel like I'm not fiddling while Rome burns, as it were, and that working on a book like that was one that I really could have the energy for the long haul, which is, to do something of that magnitude takes half a year or longer. And that was working really fast. So that's a lot of what happens to me in the process is I look for something that interests me, will hold my interest so much that I can get through the hard part of losing steam and not, not sure I'm going to be able to go on with it. You mentioned World War III, which speaking of not losing steam, when I was in art school, my friend and I were doing sort of political comics, and there was really no outlet for them, and this is in the late 70s, and we just decided to start self-publishing and print our own work, but also the work of other artists that we saw around, some things that we just saw posted on a wall or on a lamppost, and there was just so much art that was talking about the current situation, which at that time was Ronald Reagan heading towards office, and just found that self-publishing was a great route to go, and it's now 25 years later, and I'm working on editing the latest issue as well, and in so many ways, the subject matter that we were addressing hasn't changed or may have gotten worse, and a lot of things that we were talking about with great concern back in 1979-80 seems to have been coming to fruition more with things like the war in Iraq and our current political situation. So it's really been vital to have an outlet like that, and even say right after 9/11, pretty much all of us are here in New York, and we all were directly affected by it. And to be able to turn and do work on the subject when there was really almost no outlets for that in any mainstream media was a real relief to have an instant means of putting work on paper and then getting it out to other people and that form of communication.
Yeah, in many ways, also, we should mention the work you've done in the new book, Wobbly, by Paul Buell and Nicole Shulman. And that's, if you go to books in my website, listeners, peterwerby.com, you'll find both Peter Cooper's book, The Jungle, and also Wobbly. That almost looks in many ways like an extended World War III, except we should tell people we're talking about the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, which is celebrating its centenary as a union. You go to IWW.org. So, you know, when I'll tell you, when I hear the energy involved in all your projects, Peter, it just realizes how lazy I am and how I'm glad I'm on this end interviewing people about the extraordinary work they're doing. What are you involved in now? What do you have going?
Well, I'm just working on an autobiographical book, I'm starting to piece that one together. That will be probably coming from Crown, which is Random House, and that which will most certainly embarrass my daughter to no end. And that again, you know, with the in that perpetual, you know, I went from doing my last book. Couple of books was, you know, a literary adaptation and then a wordless piece, and so now I'm going to do fairly humorous autobiography just to completely change it up so that, that big boredom principle that I keep fighting against. Then I have a children's book that I wrote that I'm now circulating and wrote and drew, and you know, it's sort of a perpetual the perpetual job to keep these things going. Is I'm always throwing a lot of things at the wall and hoping that something sticks.
Well, I think a lot of this did stick. The brand new book from Peter Cooper, KUPER, go to petercooper.com, is Upton Sinclair's Jungle adaptation. Also, a wordless graphic novel, Sticks and Stones, that's available from Three Rivers Press. It'll all be on my website or petercooper.com. Peter, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Boss Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-M-O-R. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-UC-MOR. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-UC-MOR. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds. I'll see you.
Hit the great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff rocks.
This is WRIF.